Cemetery and the Pentagon, then cross the Potomac River and run by the National Mall. The event is open to everyone. It attracts runners from all 50 states and 50 countries. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Cigna Healthcare, a health benefits provider that advocates for better health through every stage of life. Learn more at Cigna.com. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps, and with Halloween in the air, there's someone I think you should meet.
Hi, my name's Honey Rose. I'm 23 years old. I'm a TikToker. I'm queer. I'm a witch. When I was just getting started learning properties of herbs, candles, synchronicities, understanding that a sign is important to you and to no one else, that's something that really was important for me to learn in the beginning. For me, hawks are often a sign. Also, sometimes it's just a feeling. I work with my ancestors, and your body works with your ancestors. So my grandmother, who passed, we called her Bird. Her birthday is actually on Halloween, and every Halloween we go to the cemetery to visit her as a matriarch of our family and someone that raised me. I love her so much. And two birds flew right above us. And then we saw hawks. Right after that, a whirlpool of leaves encased us. As soon as it got past us, it fell away. You can't tell me that's not, like, a sign from my grandmother. The fact that someone is coming to me and I can understand that clearly. I can send back messages and offerings and it will be received. That, to me, is power.
It's really you on my mind. It's really you. On my mind, it's really you. It's really you.
Welcome to the next generation of witches. They're young, they're magical, and as producer Angelo Bautista discovered, they're everywhere.
If you haven't heard already, witches are cool now. They're all over the popular video app, TikTok.
It's kind of a hub for witches.
Hello, my name's Honey, and I am a witch. So if you have some questions that you haven't been able to answer in your research, maybe I can help you out with them.
Honey Rose has over 120,000 followers and goes by the username ThatHoneyWitch. Although, as Honey explained to me,
I'm not a witch, I'm a practitioner. I say witch because it's easier for people to understand.
Can you describe your craft and what you do?
I'm not a hexer, if that's the question. Like, I'm not like out here putting people in the freezer.
Honey is a practitioner of hoodoo, a spiritual practice born out of the African diaspora.
I look at hoodoo as a way to reconnect to my ancestors that were enslaved here in America.
Hoodoo is just one of the many varieties of magic you'll find on the witchy side of TikTok, or as it's known, witch talk.
You'll find Jewish witches, Christian witches, you'll find demonologists, just straight up occultists, astrologers, sea witches, green witches, mediums, people that work with the Norse gods, people that work with Egyptian gods, array of everything, honestly.
Would you consider witch talk to be kind of the new coven?
Yeah, in a way, honestly, because there are like mass rituals that some people do. There's spreading of information, calling out misinformation. Yeah, that's a very good way to look at it. A new coven.
When practicing magic, the color of your candle is really important. Each one of these colors has different properties that can benefit your practice and your energy. Let's get into them.
On Witch Talk, you'll find jokes about summoning demons by accident, crystals that could ruin your life if you're not careful. There's livestream tarot readings, spell jar recipes, tutorials on candle magic.
Green is associated with earthly possessions and materialism. It's useful for money magic. Blue is for clarity, peace of mind.
How do you know, like, what's real or what's not?
When you say what's real and what's not, it's really about who's done their research.
But we're talking about magic here.
Magic works with reality. I'm a scientist in real life, and I'm a witch in real life. For example, I do bone divination. I have bones that are ethically sourced, of course.
Of course.
And I cast them. But just like any experiment, you have to test it. I ask questions that I know the answer to. If it doesn't tell me the correct answer, I'm not going to do that reading. I have to fix my bones. So,
one thing I find fascinating about witch talk is that you'll see witches using old magic to solve really modern day problems, like getting someone who's ignoring you to text you back.
I know I said earlier I don't put people in the freezer, but someone had ghosted me and wasn't answering me, and I was like, you're going to the freezer. And like that you're going to the freezer.
What did you do?
So putting in the freezer, the basic tools, you can have like a piece of their hair or just their name, their birthday, a photo of them, something like that, in a jar in the freezer, and you put some aluminum foil around it.
Oh, literally in the freezer.
Literally in the freezer. It kind of blocks all light from like shining in. It puts a stop on their life.
And did it work?
It works.
It did?
It did work.
What happened?
They texted me the next day. They were like, I'm sorry. I'm like, because you were in the freezer.
Witch talk does have its bad side. And I don't mean evil. Witch talk, like many online spaces, is not immune to toxic behaviors, misinformation, trolls, and conflict.
Witch talk drama you need to know. Everyone's favorite voodoo priest is at it again, and this time his target is Afro-spiritual.
Y'all want to be petty witches and fight it out video after video? I don't care.
It's getting to the point that I can't figure out which is better, Facebook mom group drama or witch talk drama.
What kind of drama? What dramas do the witches get into?
There was the debacle last year, I believe, about someone hexing the moon.
So many people have been asking how they can help with the moon situation, which or not.
I am not magically inclined, so I had to look this up. But a hex is like a spell of negative energy and restraint, and the moon is a powerful entity for witches. Hexing the moon sounds like a big no-no.
People think it was like baby witches or new witches that threatened to hex the moon, but that's not what happened. A troll? Some random guy that was like, I wanted to see if I could stir something up. And he did. And we fell for it, and it was all over Twitter. It was everywhere.
Honey assures me that it is impossible to hex the moon, so the moon is doing just fine.
Just me and the lavender.
I know what you're thinking. Hexing the moon sounds silly. But on Witch Talk, there's also a more serious, ongoing conversation amongst witches about what is and isn't culturally acceptable, who is allowed to do what magic, and that can get pretty loaded when it comes to issues of race, identity, and ancestry.
I'm tired of sugarcoating it. Just stop using white sage. I don't care if you grow it yourself. I don't care if it was gifted to you by a Native American. I don't care. That doesn't matter.
Claiming that the Romani invented the tarot and that it is closed to us, this is not the advocacy that you think it is.
I have a question for white witches and white spiritualists on TikTok. Why are our practices in your mouth? Why are you talking about chakras, karmas, and all that other shit when it's not yours?
I've actually had people say, I'm not going to listen to you, a person of color, on this issue. That was specifically on the term black magic, I believe.
Oh.
As a black practitioner, black magic is a racist term. It demonizes African traditional religions and the people that follow them. I was told, like, no, it's not racist. It's not demonizing. I've had people come on and say that African traditional religions are primitive. That's just, it's hard to hear.
With witches becoming so mainstream, sometimes I'm on Witch Talk and I feel like I'm being sold a mystical aesthetic and I'm buying into a trend.
Good morning. A lot of you have asked where I get my crystals from on Etsy, so I'm going to show you some of my favorite shops. First up is Wild Moon Child by Amara. Her shop is really affordable and I found her on TikTok.
But for Honey, it's all part of keeping the craft going. Witches supporting witches.
I can understand where you're coming from. I make the witchy aesthetic. Literally, I make cauldrons and tarot card holders. But if Witch Talk wasn't trending, then I probably wouldn't be able to sell the cauldrons that I love to make. I wouldn't have gotten so good at my tarot readings. I wouldn't have so many people to practice on, you know?
My favorite type of reading to do is an ancestor reading, just to tell you what they want to tell you, because some of y'all ancestors are so nice and they just want to talk to you and tell you how good you're doing. Like, it's so sweet.
I don't know if any amount of tarot reading or divination can tell us what will become of this next generation of witches. But I do know that TikTok would be a lot more mundane and a lot less magical without them.
Angelo Bautista talking with Honey Rose, known online as That Honey Witch. So while today's witches congregate online, let's go back. Way back about 400 years, give or take, to Europe in the early 1600s. Not an especially safe or comfortable time to live. Religious wars were tearing up the countryside. Plague stalked cities and towns. There were crop failures, pestilence, famine. And just like today, when times get tough, people looked around for a scapegoat, and they found one. Witchcraft. The witch hunts of early modern Europe were the worst in history. Between 1580 and 1630, an estimated 50,000 people were burned at the stake, most of them women. So imagine, you're an older woman, a widow, in a small town. You can't read or write, but you have a little garden, a cow, a few chickens. You make wine for your neighbors. You sell a few herbal medicines. But then one day, there's a knock at the door. One of your neighbors has denounced you as a witch. And now the local magistrate and the jailer, with his collection of thumbscrews, would like to see you.
Herein I begin my account. I maintain that I am not a witch. Never have been a witch. I'm a relative to no witches. I've never before had even the smallest run-in with the law. Not for fighting, not for cursing, not for licentiousness, not for the pettiest theft. Yet attributed to me in this trial is the power to poison, to make lame, to pass through locked doors, to be the death of sheep, goats, cows, infants, and grapevines, even to cure at will. I can't even win at backgammon, as you know.
This is the beginning of Rivka Galchin's new novel, Everyone Knows Your Mother is a Witch. And it's based on a true story of a real woman. Her name was Katharina Kepler. She lived in the small town of Leonberg, Germany. And on a nice May morning in 1615, she was accused of being a witch. She was put on trial. But unlike so many other women, Katharina Kepler was eventually acquitted because she had something unusual. She had a famous son. You might have heard of him.
Katharina Kepler was the mother of Johannes Kepler, but I personally have started thinking of Johannes Kepler, the great mathematician and astronomer, as the son of Katharina Kepler.
Can I just say, when I heard that you had written a novel about how the mother of Johannes Kepler, one of the key figures in the scientific revolution, was tried for witchcraft, I thought, this is such a brilliant premise for a novel, but it never occurred to me that it was actually true. What was she actually accused of?
The central accusation was that there was a woman in town, and the historical record seems to suggest that she was probably suffering from some sort of neurologic disease. My guess is neurosyphilis, not that I know. But she was convinced that she had been given a bitter drink by Katharina and that she'd been given a poison. But then once the idea was out there in the town, it just kind of went everywhere. And so she was accused of passing through doors that were locked. She was accused of looking at a pig and making that pig lame. She was accused of making a cow sick. And the evidence would be that she walked by that cow every day. And it just sort of opened up all the anxiety that different people in the town had about, frankly, all the terrible things that were happening to them, you know, babies dying, other people dying, painful deaths and unexpected deaths, mysterious deaths, their livestock and their livelihood being affected. It somehow just opened this channel and they found like a place to send all these anxieties.
So I completely get being just fascinated by the story and the history and wanting to dig into it. But what made you want to then go from doing the research to actually writing a novel, bringing Katharina herself to life?
There was something, you know, and it's hard to describe and feels kind of mystical, but there was something about this woman or story that for me, it transmitted across time and space. I felt very close to her, even though that's a fantasy. And I don't know, it seemed like a voice I was interested in. And there are these kind of remarkable moments when you read the trial. And one thing that's wonderful about Katharina having had this famous son and Germany being in love with keeping very accurate records is the records of the trial are available.
Did she say much?
The way the trial worked is there was women in this area would be asked to publicly display how much they regretted the harm they had caused. And if they cried in public or showed the judges that they felt remorse, their sentence would be mitigated or pity would be shown to them. But of course, it's a bind. So they're sort of asking her to cry. And there's also the record of her simply saying, I've cried so many tears in my life, I just don't have any left.
So she wouldn't cry.
She wouldn't cry. I almost feel like there's like a ray of incurable sincerity there. Under that much duress, I would I would fake anything that I need to.
I would have cried.
I would have cried.
I mean, if it means they're, you know, not going to, was at stake, what would they have done?
It's genuinely so grotesque and horrifying that you almost run the risk of that sort of pornography of suffering and misery. And it really was terrible. It was, they were burned, or they were sort of had like gunpowder put on their necks so that they would be exploded. They were put on racks. They were stretched. They did have thumb screws. And they themselves, I mean, this I also think is part of the invasion. It was quite common for women to go to an expert to find out if maybe they were a witch and just didn't know about it.
Really?
And that also, I think, is like a quite amazing form of violence into one's own kind of belief about oneself.
Yeah. All the people who are accusing her are people who know her or who have seen her every day for years and years in this small town. And they know the horrific things that could happen to her. And yet there's a kind of, I don't know, they seem almost blithe about it. It's just the intimacy of the cruelty that's so chilling.
Absolutely. It's almost like those photos of people who were working at the concentration camps, you know, running the gas chambers,
yeah,
these sorts of things. And then the photos that they took on the weekends of their picnics and,
yeah,
you know.
Exactly. I found myself halfway through the book thinking about Hannah Arendt writing about the mundanity of evil, the banality of evil, just how ordinary it can look.
I often sort of feel like, you know, a monster would be kind of interesting to battle, but a sort of diffuse indifference mixed with stupidity, mixed with pettiness, mixed with genuine fearfulness is so much more terrifying.
You could be describing today also.
Yeah.
So I want to think a little bit about witches and women. Why did people accuse women of being witches? I know it's a huge question. I know there's not just, you know, one reason, but you must have thought about that yourself.
Absolutely. And I did think that it is specifically something we do to the group that retains power despite it being their job to be powerless. So I sort of feel like there are different kinds of witches. There are the young witches. And what do they have? They're attractive, right? And that's like a kind of power. You can't sort of take it away from them. I guess you can cover them up or sort of give them a lot of rules about how they can dress and what they can do. But it's power. And I sort of can see how it's frightening to other people to see that group of people have this power. So I thought, well, that one sort of makes sense. And then a lot of the cases with the older women, which is more what was happening in Germany, these were people that were perceived as a burden. And so I think with Katharina, it was like a mix of so many things. She was an old woman and therefore sort of a burden. And at the same time, she was just mysteriously powerful. Her children had done so well. And I think that that was threatening.
Do you either have people in your life who are witches, or have you ever practiced or thought about practicing yourself?
I wish I could say I had, but no. I'm sort of still in a kind of like nerdy, sciencey, strange, down-to-earth kind of crowd.
Maybe you should, you know, try.
I know. I think you're right.
At the very least, you know, sprinkle some salt in corners just to like clear the air.
Exactly.
do some basic house magic.
I love superstition because I feel like it's almost like a form of anxiety management. It's like a great form of relating to the possible.
Yeah, I guess also almost all witchcraft that I've ever heard of, it is very earth-based. All the rituals are about connecting with the natural world. And so I'm thinking back to this period of time and the irony of it's being Johannes Kepler's mother who's accused of being a witch and the beginning of the scientific revolution when a whole new level of rational abstraction was being birthed, which would, you know, lead to things like the Industrial Revolution and our continuing march away from being part of the natural world.
You know, that's so interesting. And also, like, something that I hadn't really had a strong sense of before was the way that it's a funny moment in time because it actually is the peasants and the women who have developed mostly through an oral tradition, like a tremendous and much of it very accurate knowledge about herbs and plants and treatments and the medicine. I mean, not that it was perfect, just as it's still not perfect, but just that it was like an experiential, evidence-based kind of research project that had been going on for hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of years. It was actually not an exclusively feminine project, but a particularly feminine project. And then there is this like weird transition where they're quote unquote casting out superstitious beliefs, but also weirdly casting shade on what was actually a foundational knowledge that wasn't superstitious. So it's just like a funny lighting.
But it's also a period of time when medicine, what we think of as modern medicine, is just starting up and men are taking it over. And so there's also this kind of gendered, who are the healers thing going on.
And especially you sort of see, like, you can see men who were trying to make their living as a doctor and who found these alternative, basically cheaper practitioners, women, threatening.
Right.
And so it was as if they had to be discarded completely and had to have all this shade cast on them.
It's so interesting to me that after all these centuries, just the word witch still has so much power.
Yeah, no, it is shocking. And everyone's trying to use that power because it summarizes something for people.
Well, thank you so much for bringing Katharina back to life.
Okay, thank you so much for your time and your attention and your thoughts.
Rivka Galchin. Her new novel is called Everyone Knows Your Mother is a Witch. And coming up, with the planet in crisis and global warming threatening everyone and everything, could magic and witchcraft perhaps offer some hope for the future? We'll find out next, on To the Best of Our Knowledge, from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX.
From the University of Kansas, we are Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 Lawrence and 89.7 Emporia, online at kansaspublicradio.org. Support for KPR comes from Delta Dental of Kansas, reminding listeners to visit a dentist regularly. Dentists can be found at deltadentalks.com/find. And from the Lead Center, welcoming the classical trio of Edgar Meyer, Tessa Lark, and Joshua Roman, performing on bass, violin, and cello, Sunday, November 3rd, 2 p.m. Tickets are at lead.ku.edu. Just in time for Halloween, the Haunted States of America. Next time on KPR Presents, it's a cross-country trip of spooky stories with local authors William Mockery and Giselle Anatole. That's on KPR Presents, 6 o'clock this evening on Kansas Public Radio.
Every generation has its witches, just like every culture has its own magical beliefs and practices. So why do we persist in regarding them as part of the loony fringe, when in fact, something like 75% of the adult population of the Western world holds some belief in magic or the paranormal? So what if, instead of dismissing it as make-believe, we treated magic as a legitimate way of knowing and relating to the world? Archaeologist Chris Gosden has just written A Global History of Magic, from the Ice Age to the Internet, and he told Steve Paulson he's come to believe our own culture would be healthier and happier if we took magic a lot more seriously.
So I worked in Papua New Guinea for a long time, where everyone believes in magic. They don't have any doubt that the landscape is full of spirits, that the dead are all around them, that the world is broadly animate. There was an instance which I mention in the book where I went with a group of people and they said there was a series of stones on the ground, and under certain circumstances they felt those stones could fly around just above the ground. And if you knew how to read the movements of the stones, then it would tell you the future. And I never got to see the stones move, but I was always dead keen to do so. So part of many people's common sense in the world was a notion of magic.
So what did you make of that experience when people told you this? Were you sort of the skeptical Western scientist, or did you immerse yourself in that world?
That's a very good question. I was ambiguous, I think. So on the one hand, I had no doubt at all that my friends were intelligent, sensible people and that they thought this happened. Can I quite bring myself to believe it happens? I'm not so sure. So I'm in this weird state as to, you know, does it or doesn't it? Mm-hmm. And I think maybe, you know, I've never particularly seen a ghost, but I don't disbelieve in ghosts, as it were. So I'm one of the things I'm doing at the moment is experimenting with a greater belief in magic to see where it takes me. But I'm still constrained by my rational background.
So you talk about what you call the triple helix of human culture, religion, science, and magic, which I found so interesting because there is a common narrative about human history that first we had magic for many thousands of years, then religion, and then finally science came along as the one credible way to understand the world. And magic essentially is written off as a kind of pre-modern, antiquated worldview.
Yeah.
You don't believe that at all, do you?
I don't. No. I'm quite opposed to that view. So I think all these three strands, magic, religion, and science, are important. A belief in magic doesn't make you irrational, doesn't make you anti-science. So for me, magic is about a participation in the universe, a sort of openness to the possibility of a great range of cause and effects. You know, the stones moving, as it were, not all of which can be explained by science.
Aren't these three ways of knowing, magic, religion, and science, all making claims on what is real, what is true? And to some degrees, aren't they competing claims about what's real?
Yes, they definitely have been set up in those ways. The battles between religion and science are well known. Science and magic are well known. But for me, I think that's a wrong way of looking at things. So I think the more we can be accepting of all three of them, clear thinking, logical approaches to the world, and then rather more intuitive ways, and then a sense of awe and something beyond us. And I think it's only once you get all three of those that we're allowing ourselves to be fully human.
So if magic is so fundamental to what it means to be human, why has it gotten such a bad reputation, in the modern world at least?
Mm.
There's this phrase, magical thinking, which is usually not a compliment.
No.
It usually means, you know, oh, it's sort of like you're going into woo-woo land.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's a fairly concerted attempt in the 18th and particularly 19th century, and continuing on into the 21st century, it must be said, on the part often of scientists to poo-poo any belief system that doesn't appear to be scientific. So it goes back partly to people like Max Weber, the sociologist, who said in order to be modern, we needed to be rational. We needed to think our way through mass society, mass living.
But he also worried about this. I mean, he talked about how society had become disenchanted, that we had lost something with, you know, the disappearance of this more magical way of thinking.
Yeah, that's absolutely. But he was deeply ambiguous. I mean, I think he saw disenchantment as a necessary part of becoming modern. But then also, as you say, there was loss there. He said something along the lines of we're becoming technicians without heart and specialists without soul.
Yeah. Let's talk about one form of magic that has been especially controversial over the ages, and that's witchcraft. Is witchcraft practiced around the world? I'm assuming it comes in different forms depending on where you're talking about.
Yeah. I would guess there isn't a culture of the world that doesn't practice witchcraft in some ways. And of course, the Western world, there are lots of people who would now claim to be witches. I mean, modern day paganisms and Wiccan beliefs and those sorts of things, again, are very various, so is hard to sum up, but is often about summoning the powers of the earth, the regenerative powers, the powers of growth and health. But then again, there's, you know, malign forms of witchcraft. So the bit of New Guinea I worked in, there were sorcerers, and there was a very scary man who was seen as a sorcerer, and I was quite scared of him. And he definitely, I mean, who knows whether he was a sorcerer or not? No, nobody there had any doubt, but he played on that fact. And he died and then came back to life. They were about to bury him, and then he sat up. And that really cemented his reputation as a sorcerer, man who cheated death.
I bet it would.
Yeah, and that made me even more scared of him. Yeah.
What about the modern Wiccan movement? Does that draw on this history that we've been talking about, or is that kind of its own thing?
Bit of both. So in Britain, people will talk about Druid beliefs and so on, mm-hmm. which are in any case extraordinarily poorly known, but people feel like they're going back to Iron Age ways of doing things. But then there are other people who are much more modern, you know, the TikTok witches and all those sorts of things. So, I mean, I think that's the fascinating thing about magic. It doesn't just sit there as a sort of old bit of belief that somehow survived into the modern world. People are always inventing it and reinventing it. All the apps for astrology, and younger people I know consult their astrology apps, and in a really interesting, slightly tongue-in-cheek, but they keep doing it. Mm-hmm. They get out the tarot cards. I mean, I think there's all sorts of ways in which people are playing, really. Does this work?
Yeah.
Should I bother with it?
Kind of, you know, bringing in a new piece of information to weigh alongside all the other stuff that you look at.
Yes, and I think now in the 21st century, people are slightly dubious about the claims that rationality makes to being the only way of understanding the universe, and also a pretty deep sense that we may not, as a globe, be going in anything like the right direction, that extracting material from the world continuously is not a good idea, and maybe we do need a more sort of kindly, caring, broader notion of our relationship with the world around us.
Steve was talking with Chris Gosden. He's a professor of European archaeology at the University of Oxford and author of the book Magic, A History.
Bone Courage, potion number 2. One cup bourbon, a third cup sweet vermouth, many shakes from the bottle of bitters, the pewter bear knick-knack from the living room end table. Mix everything in a mason jar, then chill overnight outside on the windowsill in the waxing light of the moon. Steep a small bear figurine in the potion to infuse it with the courage of the bear. As we learned in world history, the word berserk probably derives from bear shirt, a garment made from the skin of a bear that Viking warriors donned in order to give them inhuman strength in battle. Bear of night, walk the earth. Fill my lungs with your breath. Give me courage, give me strength. Live in me, bear of night. Oh, and don't forget to refill Dad's Jim Beam with water.
Quan Barry takes us deep into a coven of field hockey-playing, Janet Jackson-listening teenage witches, circa 1989. Next. I'm Anne Strainchamps, and this is To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX.
From the University of Kansas, we are Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 Lawrence and 90.3 Chanute. online at kansaspublicradio.org. Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge on KPR comes from First Presbyterian Church in Lawrence, working to provide a welcoming and safe environment for everyone. Information on ministries and firstpreslawrence.org. And from the Lead Center, welcoming the classical trio of Edgar Meyer, Tessa Clark, and Joshua Roman, performing on bass, violin, and cello, Sunday, November 3rd, 2 p.m. Tickets are at lead.ku.edu. Sunny and warm today, with highs getting up to the mid-70s. Even warmer for tomorrow, with highs in the mid-80s. It's 57 in Lawrence. This is KPR.
If there was ever a good time and place to be a witch, it was America in the late 1980s. Big hair, baggy, acid-washed denim. Pat Benatar, Madonna, and Stevie Nicks told girls to express themselves. Feminists reclaimed the mother goddess. Neo-pagans revived earth magic, and women everywhere started covens. Among them, the girls' field hockey team at Danvers High School in Massachusetts. At least that's how Quan Barry imagines it in her recent novel, We Ride Upon Styx. Shannon Henry Kleiber caught up with her.
I wanted to start with setting the scene in We Ride Upon Styx. It's 1989 in Danvers, Massachusetts, the site of the Salem witch trials, 300 years later. So who are the Danvers Falcons?
So the Danvers Falcons, they're the varsity women's field hockey team, and they begin the 1989 season as a definite rags-to-riches sort of story.
I think our generation, we need shampoo and conditioner.
Emilio Estevez, Young Guns.
The book begins, they're at a summer camp up in New Hampshire, Camp Wildcat. And they're basically the bottom of the bottom. The very first scene, we see them losing a scrimmage, you know, 8 or 9 to nothing. Nobody's even quite sure of the score because there's so many goals that have been scored against them. So they're really pretty demoralized. You know, it's kind of been the story of their lives that they're the sort of the worst team in the New England Conference, right? But then, you know, because they've hit their bottom, their goalie decides to take matters into her own hands and to look for alternative ways of winning.
I played field hockey on an all-girls team in the late 80s in Maryland. I had the mouth guard, the shin guards, the kilt. Yeah, it just all brought so many memories back to me. I loved the pop culture references that you used. Benetton, Esprit, Swatch, Pat Benatar. Did you live through this too? I mean, it seemed like you knew so much.
Yes, the book is definitely in that sense fairly autobiographical. I did indeed grow up in the town of Danvers on the North Shore of Boston. As you mentioned, Danvers is where the young women, the girls, first began the accusations that led to the Salem witch trials. Back in 1692, Danvers was actually known as Salem Village. So I always knew that aspect of things when I was growing up. And then because I did come of age in the 1980s, which in many ways are just ridiculous, you know, when you go back and you think about just the hair, the bands, the music, the clothes, you know, all of that stuff. It's just a level of just, again, just fun and camp is just present in that.
Leave her alone.
You gonna make me?
Let's end this right now. You don't talk to her. You don't look at her. You don't even think about her. You understand me?
So what's the book with Emilio Estevez on the cover? And why him?
So Emilio Estevez, I knew that I wanted to have, you know, an 80s heartthrob be the person who was on the cover in which they make this pledge to the powers of darkness. It's a very generic powers of darkness. You know, we never get any specific names like the devil or Beelzebub or anything like that.
And he's kind of their spell book, right? I mean, this their equivalent of a coven's book of spells.
Yeah, the book of spells, book of shadows sometimes they're referred to. So the book of shadows is where you keep your spells and all those kinds of things. I also think it's kind of funny because when I think of Emilio Estevez, He seems to have like these chipmunk cheeks, and he's all American, you know, in many kinds of ways. And yet here he is being, you know, invoked as this power of darkness.
Your songs throughout the book, the 80s songs, it was like there was a soundtrack playing as I was reading it, which is so fun.
Yeah.
Was it like that writing it? Did you just keep hearing these songs in your head and then you wove them into the book?
It helped with the narrative at various times. Towards the end, for example, we get Cinderella pops up and there's a couple lines from a Cinderella song, or Halloween, you know, we get Monster Mash, which is not particularly 80s, but it helps with the Halloween vibe. I'm not saying that they're a shortcut, but they allow you really quickly to establish a mood.
Do you think of this as a feminist book?
I do. Yeah, I really do. Witchcraft to me has always been a feminist issue. It's the idea that women through the ages, historically, who were accused of being witches, were women who didn't fit into society for whatever reason. Either they were too old, or they didn't have children, or they were too powerful. For example, one of the first women who was hung as part of the Salem witch trials is this woman, Bridget Bishop. And she had been accused before. Somehow the charges were dropped. And the main accusations, one of the reasons why people think she was singled out is because she wasn't married. She was a tavern owner. She was quite successful. And it's also said that allegedly she liked to wear red. Mm-hmm. And so when you think about that, you know, those reasons as to why perhaps she was chosen and why these girls accused her, witchcraft has always been seen as women who were on the margins for whatever reason. But I think that particularly, you know, in the 20th century, as you get Wiccans coming back into the scene, obviously there've always been Wiccans, there's always been pagans, but it has been about women reclaiming various spheres of power. And so I do think that this book is very much a feminist book. And I was very much thinking about women and their voices and empowerment and all those kinds of things.
Definitely. And their friendship too, their sisterhood. Can you read to me one of the potions? I'm looking at the irresistible potion on page 189.
So there's a character named Boy Corey. It's true that although field hockey is primarily a girl sport, occasionally there are boys who play it. And so Boy Corey is playing. He's the only boy on the field hockey team. And he is experimenting with different kinds of spells and seeing what kinds of effects they have. And he's also keeping a diary, which each of the players does. They keep an individual diary, and then those diaries are collected each week and they're stapled into Emilio. And you're supposed to be keeping a diary of all the dark, sinister things you're doing, and that dark, sinister energy is essentially what's fueling Emilio and giving the team their power. And so this is Boy Corey's entry. Monday, first week of November. Greetings and salutations. As I am quite sure you are well aware, ever since Halloween, the ladies and I are now in the business of casting spells and brewing potions. World, wish me luck. Irresistible potion number one. Half cup water. A dollop of honey. The ultimate attractor. One pinch of sugar. Cinnamon for taste. One of my baby teeth from mom's keepsake boxes, a mirror from a makeup compact. Put everything in a pot and bring to a boil. When cool, transfer to a mason jar. Each night before bed, light a candle and visualize what you want. Fill a thimble with irresistible potion number one, trademark pending, and down the hatch. Obviously, before drinking, strain out the mirror and the tooth, which are only intended because A, once I sink my teeth into the intended, may I never be forgotten. And B, when I am gazed upon, may the intended see all the things they like best about themselves reflected back at them. Repeat for at least 3 nights.
Always loved Halloween. What's your relationship to it?
So it's true that the last couple of years I've worn the same costume every year. It's a costume that I created called the Kwan. People who don't know, Dr. Seuss actually invented his own alphabet. And one of the letters that he invented is called the Kwan.
It kind of looks like a Q, but it's a very Dr. Seuss Q, so it's a Q that's not a traditional-looking Q. And so every year I dress up as the Kwan. As a kid from a family that didn't get a lot of candy, because my mom did not roll like that, Halloween was a big deal to us. For example, my mother didn't let us trick-or-treat off the street. Our street wasn't that big. My mother thought, it's a fine amount of candy. You don't need to go to thousands of streets and come back with these pillowcases. She always thought that was terrible. So we could only, trick-or-treat on our street. After I graduated from college, I lived at home for a year before I went to graduate school. I saw Halloween in Salem. Halloween in Salem now is very different. It's very family friendly. They figured out a way to really monopolize and capitalize and make money. They call it Halloween season. It basically is the entire month of October.
Oh.
But it used to be, when I saw Halloween in Salem on Halloween night, it's very similar to what happens in the book. There were actually protesters out holding signs saying, 3 John 3:16, and saying things about suffer not a witch to live. And the Wiccans and the pagans were actually marching in Salem, and it was a celebration, a memorial to the people who had died. And yet there were still protesters, not tons of them, but people like yelling and screaming and things like that. So yes, I've always had a soft spot for Halloween. Now I think about it, it's the idea of transformation, the idea of mask wearing, and just in some ways, some people become more themselves when they have a costume on, It allows them, for whatever reason, to let something inside go. And so I am interested in that, yeah.
She's a girl that I was madly in love with when we were freshmen.
Life's like a movie, write your own ending.
Do you think there's a little witch in all of us?
I hope so, because like I said, to me, it's about the idea of having dreams and figuring out how to make them come true, right? So we're all kind of magicians in certain kinds of ways, So the whole family, we went to see the Muppet movie. And I still remember at the end, when Kermit sings, "Life's like a movie, write your own ending." In some ways, there's something kind of witchy about that. Life's like a movie, write your own ending. So it's the idea that, that we're magicians creating our own realities. And in many ways, that's what I see witchcraft is doing.
You have to believe we are magic. Nothing can stand in our way.
Novelist Kwan Barry talking with producer Shannon Henry Kleiber about her recent novel, We Ride Upon Sticks. And here's hoping you put some witchcraft in your own life soon. And not just at Halloween. We all deserve a bit of magic every day. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from our little audio coven in Madison, Wisconsin. Shannon Henry Kleiber was head witch this week. Angelo Bautista and Charles Monroe Kane stirred the cauldron. Mark Rickers provided digital dark arts, and Joe Hartke cast a web of sonic sorcery. Our executive wizard is Steve Paulson, and I am your witchy host, Anne Strainchamps. Be well, and join us again next time. The magic continues with another hour of To the Best of Our Knowledge coming up on Kansas Public Radio. From the University of Kansas, we're KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1 Oldsburg Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute 90.3. Tell your smart speakers to play Kansas Public Radio. Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge on KPR comes from the Noto Arts and Entertainment District of Topeka, inviting listeners to the Dia de los Muertos Festival on Friday, featuring the Celebration of Souls exhibit on loan from the Chicago Field Museum. Details at explorenoto.org.
It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. What scares you?
I remember being so afraid of The Wizard of Oz that I had to watch it from outside the room. I'd standing in the door so that I could slip out whenever the witch showed up. But for some reason, at the same time, I was really magnetically drawn to this sort of scary stuff, wanting to find a way to conquer it.
That's the underlying rationale for Halloween, isn't it? Our annual collective exercise in knowing and maybe conquering the scary stuff. Ghosts, ghouls, demons, devils, things that go bump in the night. That's all coming up on To the Best of Our Knowledge, a Halloween edition. First this.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. The presidential campaigns are focusing on key swing states this weekend. Kamala Harris will be in Philadelphia today after campaigning in Michigan yesterday with former First Lady Michelle Obama. This was the first time the two have appeared together as Harris focuses her campaign on reproductive rights. NPR's Deepa Shivaram reports.
In Kalamazoo, Obama said people were holding Harris and her opponent, former President Trump, to different standards. She also spoke at length directly to men about how further limits and restraints on access to women's health care would impact them and their sons, too.
So I am asking y'all from the core of my being to take our lives seriously. Please.
Her remarks echoed what Harris has been saying over the weekend as she tries to increase support from men who are favoring Trump over her. Deepa Shivaram, NPR News, Kalamazoo, Michigan.
Former President Donald Trump was also in Pennsylvania yesterday seeking support from young men during a rally at Penn State University.
Kamala will destroy your inheritance, but much more importantly, she's going to destroy your country. If you vote for me, I will ensure that you begin your careers, young people, in a roaring economy in a time of unprecedented peace and prosperity.
Trump is taking his campaign to New York City's Madison Square Garden for a rally tonight. Israel is holding an official Memorial Day to commemorate its civilians, soldiers, and officers who were killed throughout the continuing war. NPR's Daniel Estrin reports from Tel Aviv. There were deadly new Israeli strikes in North Gaza and a truck ramming in central Israel.
Israeli police say a truck driver rammed into a group of people at a bus stop next to a military intelligence base, wounding several dozen people before armed civilians shot the driver. In Gaza, health officials report more than 30 people killed in Beit Lahia in North Gaza Saturday night. Gaza's Civil Defense First Responder Group says it's no longer able to respond to calls for help because of the intense Israeli military assault there. Israel is holding official memorial ceremonies marking the anniversary, according to the Hebrew calendar, of the deadly October 7th Hamas attack on Israel and commemorating those civilians, soldiers, and security personnel also killed in the past year of war. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
The United Nations Security Council is expected to convene tomorrow at the request of Iran to discuss Israel's attacks on Iran this weekend. It claims the attacks violate international law. The Israeli ambassador to the UN called it another attempt by Iran to harm Israel, this time in the diplomatic arena. Ambassador Danny Dannon said Israel has the right and duty to defend itself and protect its citizens. This is NPR News in Washington. Japan is holding parliamentary elections today. According to exit polls, the Liberal Democratic Party of Prime Minister Shigeru Ishiba is likely to lose the majority in the 465-seat House. Ishiba had called for the snap elections shortly after taking office this month, hoping to win public support for his leadership. His predecessor had resigned over the cost of living and a scandal involving donations to lawmakers. Tens of thousands of demonstrators from the left and the right took to the streets of London this weekend in three separate protest marches. Vicky Barker reports from the British capital.
Supporters of the far-right figure Tommy Robinson waved British flags and chanted his name at their London march, supporting those arrested in this summer's racist anti-immigrant riots. Robinson wasn't there. He'd been jailed for contempt of court after repeating libelous allegations against a Syrian refugee. Police held them away from this. Counter-demonstrators from the organization Stand Up to Racism. At a separate march against police brutality, the family of Chris Caba delivered a letter to Prime Minister Keir Starmer protesting the acquittal of the police officer who shot the unarmed 40-year-old to death 2 years ago. For NPR News, I'm Vicky Barker in London.
In the World Series, the Los Angeles hold a 2-0 lead after beating the New York Yankees last night. Game 3 is tomorrow night in New York. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Cy Sims Foundation. Since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org.
It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. The thing about Halloween is, most of the year, we do our best to keep fear at arm's length. We steel ourselves against nightmares. And then this one time of the year, this one day, we let it all out. It's like this national collective exorcism. Well, today, to help you get in the mood, let's think about something sinister, something toxic, something that's hiding all around us. Sometimes in plain sight. Poison.
So I was visiting a scientist who works on developing new varieties of lilies. He's a lily expert. As we were getting ready to leave, he said, "Hang on a minute, I want to show you something else I have growing in the corner over here. But don't tell anyone about this. I don't want my boss to know that I have one of these." The plant that he had was circulating among students on campus. And so students were telling him, "We're growing Erythroxylum coca, which is the plant that cocaine comes from." It was a South American shrub. It would be very hard to grow. The traditional Bolivian way to consume coca leaves is to chew on it. So this guy was immediately suspicious and said, "I don't think that's what you have. I don't see that growing in a dorm room. And I'm worried about what you kids are doing with that plant." But it took him a long time to get anyone to trust him enough to bring him a specimen of this plant. And sure enough, it was not Erythroxylum coca. And I don't remember the name of the plant, but it was quite deadly. It was quite toxic. And if you chewed on enough of those leaves, your throat would close up and you wouldn't be able to breathe and you'd have to go to the hospital. So that's what he had. And that's what got me thinking about how easily it is for people to be misled or fooled. Look, I go on a walk either through a garden or on a hike with someone and they'll pluck a berry off a bush and go, "Here, try this." And I'm always like, "You know what? I'm good."
So pick your poison carefully.
I got to thinking, you know, there are a lot of famous stories in history about poisonous plants. Socrates was killed by hemlock and on. And I thought it would be interesting to tell those stories, not to write a field guide to poisonous plants, but to talk about when plants have actually killed someone or been used in warfare or for some dark and nefarious purpose.
Amy Stewart is a mystery writer. She's the author of the best-selling Cop Sisters series. She is also a serious gardener with a side gig, writing about wicked plants. She introduced Shannon Henry Kleiber to a few of her favorites.
Abraham Lincoln's mother was killed by a plant. She was killed in a very indirect way. The plant is white snake root. It's poisonous. Cows would graze on this plant. The poison would make them sick, but also get into their milk, and people would drink the milk and get sick and die. And that was called milk sickness. And it was a real problem throughout the 1800s, in fact.
The mystery part of it is interesting.
It took us a long time to really understand how plant poisons work, in part because how do you even do those experiments? The KGB starts assassinating people with ricin, which is an extract of the castor bean seed. And we did not, in medical science, even know how much ricin it took to kill a person. So as late as the 1970s, we're doing experiments where we're figuring out what would be the lethal dose for a pig that weighs roughly the equivalent of a human. It's amazing how much we still don't know about toxins in plants.
I read that you have a poisonous plant garden and that it's been listed as one of the, I think, 18 most unusual gardens in the world.
Well,
tell me about that.
I wanted to grow these plants. It's weird to write a book about plants that you've never grown and maybe never even seen. And some of them are pretty hard to get. You can't just walk into a garden center and say, I would like 12 mandrakes. Mm-hmm. They're just not for sale. But as I'm doing these interviews and reaching out to people in the horticulture community, plants start getting offered to me.
Kind of secretly, like?
Actually, yes. Yeah. I really did go visit a farm that grew a lot of very poisonous and strange plants, including some illegal plants. It was up in the hills. And before I went up there, where I knew there was going to be no cell phone coverage, I remember calling my husband and going, if I don't call you back in an hour, something has happened up there.
What plants?
So like ayahuasca, maybe you've heard of. Yeah. A hallucinogenic plant from South America, things that maybe are not quite illegal, but that the DEA is very aware of and that are hallucinogenic plants. But they were growing straight up, you know, it was a pot farm and it was a, I mean, they were growing other illegal, straight up illegal plants as well.
So you started collecting.
Yeah, so I start collecting them, but they need to go somewhere. So I planted a poison garden and I really made it, I had fun making it creepy. So like rather than plant markers, I had these cement tombstones that identified what the plant does to you, madness or blindness. I found a company that makes resin skeletons for medical schools and they sell their factory seconds online.
Cool.
So I had all these slightly defective skulls and hands. And so
incredible.
Right, yeah. Like a skeleton buried. So it was creepy and wonderful, but not terribly practical.
Was it beautiful? I mean, opium poppies are beautiful, right?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of these are very pretty plants. So I was growing foxglove digitalis, which is a heart medication. It's a great example of a plant that's both medicine and poison, depending on the dose and who's taking it. And tobacco's beautiful. It flowers and it's, depending on which one you grow, can be quite large and impressive looking plant. Mm-hmm. So yeah, a lot of them are very pretty.
I've heard that some people think plants have a consciousness. I was reading something about maybe the nightshades have an ability to hate. Do you think that's true?
Well, I'm fascinated by this, and it is something that we're finding out more about. So one way that plants communicate is through root exudates. So they exude chemicals out of the roots into the soil, and those root exudates can attract certain microbes or other living creatures that might help the plant do better or ward off enemies. And there are also plants that do the same thing above ground, that if they're under attack, they can release a pheromone that would attract the predator of the bug that's attacking them. So in other words, they can signal for help.
Mm-hmm.
So this certainly suggests that they're able to react to stimuli around them in a way that we didn't know was possible. And we're sort of just starting to figure out.
Do you think that there's a reason that we have these toxic plants in our world?
Oh, sure. They're just defending themselves. This is something I try to remind people of, is that you don't have to be terrified of poisonous plants. They're just trying to make a living, you know, they're trying to protect themselves against predators. It's a mistake to think that because something's green and comes out of the ground, that it's all natural and it's therefore good for us. Mm-hmm. You know, we tend to think that anything that's plant-based is more healthy and superior in some way, but strychnine is 100% plant-based. Mm-hmm. So is cyanide. So is ricin. They're just trying to keep from getting eaten. Plants are rooted in the ground. They don't have opposable thumbs. They can't run and hide. They can't fight back. But, you know, that's why plants have thorns or spines or stinging nettles. I mean, they're all just trying to keep predators away. So they inflict pain and suffering on anyone who tries to eat them.
That was Amy Stewart. She writes mystery novels in addition to books like Drunken Botanist and Wicked Plants. And that was Shannon Henry Kleiber talking with her. One of the really fascinating things about poisons is that in small doses, they can cure, but in larger doses, kill. So much power in a simple leaf or a mushroom or a white powder. So much potential. For the right or wrong person, it can be tempting. Catherine, if I wanted to poison someone today, what would be the best way to go about it?
First of all, I assume that you want to get away with it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, well, in that case, what you need to do is a very good study of a person's health, and if they have any particular diseases, you want to pick a poison that mimics some of the symptoms. What you're trying to do is avoid the autopsy. The other alternative, of course, is to poison someone using whatever you want and then flee the country to somewhere that doesn't have an extradition treaty. That's your only real option if you want to poison someone and get away with it.
And what about delivery mechanisms?
It's really person-specific. Contact poisons, poisons that have been inhaled, injected, swallowed, added to food.
It's a very intimate kind of killing, don't you think?
It's a statement. It is quite staggering and terrifying, the amount of thought that goes into these processes. It's very, very devious and unpleasant.
Catherine Harkup is a chemist with an expertise in poison. She lives in Valencia, Spain. I won't speculate as to why, but we reached her by Skype. She's also made a close study of a famous poisoner, someone who knocked off a good 300 victims, using everything from arsenic to cyanide. Her name? Agatha Christie. The mystery writer.
Oh, she was so good. You just mention Agatha Christie, and you can imagine a body on a library carpet with a half-spilt cup of tea next to them. And, you know, that's what Agatha Christie was about.
One of her favorites was arsenic. How come?
It was extraordinarily popular among British poisoners in the 19th century. It was used a frightening amount to bump off spouses and various rich relatives.
Wasn't it called the inheritance powder?
Yeah, the French gave it the glorious name of inheritance powder. It was embarrassingly easy to get hold of. Certainly before the 1850s in the UK, you could just walk into almost any shop and just ask outright for arsenic, and they'd just hand it over to you.
It's a pretty gruesome way to die, isn't it?
It's horrific. I think TV and films, they do a massive disservice, because if you watch TV poisonings, people take a forkful of food, they choke a bit, and they're dead on the floor in seconds. And that's not how it happens in the vast majority of cases. Poisoning takes, depending on the poison, but most cases, poisoning takes hours. And it is an agonizing few hours. It is very upsetting for all concerned.
Which brings me to actually one of the things that always makes me a little uneasy reading, especially Christie's novels. She usually uses poisons that people can get hold of, sometimes that they can just brew up themselves, say from plants growing in the garden.
Mm-hmm.
I always used to read them and think, I don't think you should be letting people know this. Has anybody ever actually copied her murders in the real world?
There are a few examples where that has happened. There was a case in France where a man, for reasons I don't know, he took a strong dislike to this particular woman who was a great friend of his uncle's. And so he had this particularly devious ploy to get rid of her. He added atropine to a bottle of wine and gave the wine to his uncle as a gift. known that his uncle very rarely, if ever, drank wine. So he thought his uncle would be safe, but special occasion, when the friend comes around, they'll open up the wine and the woman will die. Unfortunately, the uncle saved the wine for Christmas Day.
Oh, no.
He and his wife drank it, and unfortunately, he died. Now, the uncle was quite old. People put it down to natural causes. But when they went round to the uncle's house to kind of clear up and prepare everything for the funeral, there was this bottle of wine on the table. And, you know, this is France. They're like, well, it's wine. So they toasted the uncle. And these people got sick as well. So this was the first alert that it was something sinister going on. So they went round to this guy's flat and they searched his flat for evidence. And they found an Agatha Christie book. And the book just happened to fall open at the page with the atropine poisoning in it. And he was convicted.
Oh, my gosh. That's the first case I know of murder through literary influence.
Well, as I always point out to anyone who is thinking of using Agatha Christie as inspiration, the murderer always gets found out.
In some of those classic murder mysteries, I remember detectives referring to poison as a woman's weapon.
Mm-hmm.
And with some contempt. Like, if you're a man, you're going to stand up straight and bludgeon somebody to death. But a woman will sneak arsenic into your dessert while smiling in your face.
It's complete rubbish. Yes, women use poison more often than men, but in terms of pure numbers, there are more male poisoners than female.
Hmm.
And women still use other methods more often than they use poison. So unfortunately, it's a bit of a myth that poison is a woman's weapon. Agatha Christie, which you mentioned, she was rather egalitarian about the whole thing. I think she had a 50-50 split for her poisoning.
Equal opportunity poisoning. Catherine Harkup is a chemist and writer and author of A is for Arsenic. We tracked her down in Spain, where she's currently investigating another classic literary poisoner, William Shakespeare. Coming up, an argument that the dread, the fear, the horror of it all is good for you. I'm Anne Strange-Hamps. As to the best of our knowledge, from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX.
It may be good for you, but it's not good for me. We're live. We're local. We are Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas. We're 91.5 Lawrence and 99.5 Manhattan. We're online at kansaspublicradio.org. Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge on KPR comes from Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Kansas, committed to a healthier future for all Kansans, with healthcare coverage for businesses and their employees. Learn more at bcbsks.com/business. And from the Lead Center, welcoming the classical trio of Edgar Meyer, Tessa Lark, and Joshua Roman, performing on bass, violin, and cello, Sunday, November 3rd, 2 p.m., Tickets are at lead.ku.edu. Sunny skies, warm temperatures today with highs getting up to the mid-70s. It's 61 in Lawrence.
From San Francisco, listener Mark Pantoja sent us a scary story. It's called Reset.
Yeah, document's a little behind schedule, but it's shaping up.
Can we review it in the next hour?
No. Sorry about the delay. I'll send it your way this afternoon.
Okay.
Just make a quick call and we'll wrap things up.
Great.
Thanks.
Welcome back to ReLife. Would you like to talk to a loved one?
I can only talk to her for a few minutes before she starts to ask all the wrong questions and get upset. I could dumb it down, but then That's not who Abigail was. She was always smart, always sharp, always a step ahead.
I'll get Abigail on the line.
I talked to her on the phone. When she was alive, it was always text or chat or video. I think that's the first thing that sets her off.
What's so important you had to call?
They got her voice right. Copied from cell phone and YouTube videos.
This is what happens when you try to message me.
And they got her pauses and inflection and laughs down perfectly. There wasn't much of her mind left to trawl after the accident. So they rendered her from tweets and reviews and comments and likes and Netflix scandal crap they used to peddle.
So cute.
Useless garbage to her.
This is the best thing all week.
They reverse engineered her with marketing.
I just thought of you. I heart you.
We talk until she starts to complain about not being able to check her email.
Why won't my apps refresh?
She never guesses. Who guesses they're a simulation? But she knows something's wrong.
Where's Mom? Can I talk to her? Why did you call me, Dad? Where are you? Dad? Dad? Where are you?
I don't know where she is. In the ground? On a server in Russia?
Dad?
I'm sorry, baby. I just wanted to hear your voice.
Where am I?
There are questions I can't ask. I don't want to know the answers.
I feel like I'm in a movie or something.
I always end the conversation before any crying. Would she cry?
I don't know where to begin.
Does her simulation feel anything?
I'm confused sometimes.
Sometimes I think of letting her go. Erasing her.
What is up with you? What is up with this?
How many dark rooms out there are filled with people endlessly replaying loved ones? Or Michael Jackson. Or Elvis.
Why aren't you saying anything?
Would you like to save this conversation?
But I never do. I always factory reset my daughter. So we have the same conversation, day after day. The same brief few minutes when everything is like it was. I had her rendered so I could tell her how much I love her and tell her goodbye. But I can't do it. I can't let go.
I miss you. Hugs!
Was she always so affectionate? It's hard to remember what she was like before. Sometimes I wonder how well they've marketed to me.
We should hang more often.
Reset, a story by listener Mark Pantoja, acted by Bruce Bradley and Lila Rivard-Hoster. And now, writer Gemma Files makes the case for horror as comfort food.
How can spending all your time playing out negative scenarios in fiction help you live a more positive life? I get asked this a lot as a horror author. I know for myself that Wes Craven's observation about horror being far more comforting than real life because it at least has set rules makes a lot of sense to me. By allowing myself to think my way through all the worst things that could potentially happen to me or my loved ones, in a fictional space, I feel as though I can cultivate at least a modicum of control in the face of the truly uncontrollable. It also supports my general thesis that horror, far from being a narrow niche market, actually involves bedrock human experiences and impulses. The awful mysteries that everyone will eventually be confronted by. Why not take an informed approach to things like mortality and loss, rather than allow them to spring out on you without warning? By consuming horror, I guarantee that nothing is ever off the table for me to contemplate. I'm thus able to meet things head on. The well-adjusted sense of my own capabilities, even a type of black humor, which allows me to emerge from sudden disasters, bent and bruised, but hopefully never broken. I have a son, and my son has special needs. He's on the autism spectrum. And I have to say that I believe that my background in horror allowed me to accept that and contemplate both the worst and the best things that could happen in his life with a little more equanimity than a person who hadn't already been used to playing those things out in their head. That's what I believe. It's potentially possible that other people have other things that they rely on. Religion, perhaps. My husband's uncle is the priest who married us, and his father is a deacon, and he's a Catholic, but you know, I'm not. So, horror is my thing. Horror is my church. I'm already used to thinking about things like, well, what if my son gets hit by a car? What if he gets a horrible disease? What if a demon comes into his mouth when he's yawning too wide? Whatever. That when something does pop up, when, for example, your father comes from Australia and says, you know, Cal isn't really responding the way that all the other kids of his age I've seen respond to stimulus, respond to other people. Yeah, you have your moment of, Dad, what the hell do you know? But then after that, you let yourself cry and you get on with it. It's not the worst thing that could happen. Very little is the worst thing that could happen.
Writer Gemma Files with her Dangerous Idea. And you can find more Dangerous Ideas on our website at ttbook.org. One of the creepiest books I've read recently is Dan Shaun's collection of short stories called Stay Awake. It's horror, but the creep factor comes from their everydayness, their ordinariness. It's a whole book of stories of people who are alive but feel like ghosts. Here's an example.
More and more, he thought, his days at the grocery store were like being in a zombie movie, except that here the undead appeared to be too depressed to be cannibals. You didn't even realize most of the time that they were dead, and he had the worrisome thought that he would look up and there would be his mom. Or there would be he himself, Patrick Lane, gray-skinned and surprised-looking, standing at the end of an empty checkout aisle. It had occurred to him that if the undead don't realize that they are dead, he might easily be one of them himself.
So you were really drawn to the dark side from early on.
I was, and I don't quite know why, because I was a really scaredy kid. I was terrified of the dark. I remember being so afraid of The Wizard of Oz that I had to watch it from outside the room. I'm standing in the door so that I could slip out whenever the witch showed up. But for some reason, at the same time, I was really like magnetically drawn to this sort of scary stuff. And I think it had to do with wanting to find a way to conquer it, or at least to know it.
So people are talking about this new book as a collection of ghost stories, and you've talked about it too that way, but we're not talking about the white ghost in the sheet kind of thing.
No, so not. I don't think there's even anything supernatural that happens in most of the stories.
But would you still call this a collection of ghost stories?
To me, ghosts have to do with the things that we can't quite escape, even though they're not tangible. I think a lot about the people that we were in the past, and whether those people still exist in some way.
I also think about the ways in which we try to escape our pasts. And I think those pasts contain ghosts for all of us.
He had been a different person back then, a drunk, a monster. At 18, he married the girl he'd gotten pregnant and then had set about slowly, steadily ruining all their lives. When he'd abandoned them, his wife and son, back in Nebraska, he had been 24, a danger to himself and others. Years later, when he was sober, he wanted to own up to his behavior, to pay the back child support, to apologize, but they were nowhere to be found.
We should talk about, for example, the first story in the book, mm-hmm. Bees.
Yes.
The setting is in some ways the most mundane kind of setting you could imagine. This character is, what, he drives a truck for UPS?
He's a UPS driver, yeah. He's just married. His wife's a nurse. They've had a kid. They're really pretty happy. Then their son starts having these night terrors, I guess you would call them. He wakes up screaming. And this brings up a secret that the main character has been hiding, which is that when he was younger, he had another family that he had abandoned.
Doesn't know if they're alive or dead,
but begins to feel very certain that the son that he abandoned is out to get him.
In the dream, DJ is older. He looks to be 19 or 20, and he walks into a bar where Gene is hunched on a stool, sipping a glass of beer. Gene recognizes him right away, his posture, those thin shoulders, those large eyes. But now DJ's arms are long and muscular, tattooed. There is a hooded, unpleasant look on his face as he ambles up to the bar, pressing in next to Gene. DJ orders a shot of Jim Beam, Gene's old favorite. "I've been thinking about you a lot, ever since I died," DJ murmurs. Gene puts a trembly cigarette to his mouth and breathes on it, choking on the taste. He wants to say, "I'm sorry, forgive me," but he can't breathe. DJ shows his small, crooked teeth. "I know how to hurt you," DJ whispers.
And then I won't give away what happens, but it's very, very creepy.
Good things don't happen, generally, in this book.
So I wanted to ask you about creating the atmosphere of a ghost story, because, you know, we were talking about America being haunted. I think you see that even in the American landscape, at least in the landscapes that you create in these stories. Is that something you really thought about consciously?
Well, I'm drawn to that kind of landscape, and I grew up in western Nebraska, which has a really stark kind of beauty, but also a sense of emptiness and inhospitality. I think about the town where I grew up, which was a little grain elevator town on the Union Pacific Railroad line. I Google mapped it recently, and it's not there. It's just not there.
So you come from a ghost town.
Well, and I live in one now. There are a couple of stories that are set in Cleveland post economic bust 2008 disaster. And there's this sense of foreboding in these empty houses and overgrown lawns and boarded up storefronts that I see a lot of. And I know that the Cleveland Chamber of Commerce is going to hunt me down and kill me, but I love Cleveland. I'm not talking down on it, but there is something about that part of the landscape that's really inspiring to me and really interesting, even as it's kind of spooky.
Which makes me wonder, is America haunted?
Oh, it's incredibly haunted. It's haunted by not only the things that we want to reinvent, but also by the things that we want to forget, that we don't want to talk about. And so much of our politics is about not talking about things.
So I wanted to ask about your personal reasons for being drawn to some of the themes that we've been talking about, hauntedness and the ghosts of lives not lived or lives past. You were adopted.
Yeah.
Is that the kind of thing you thought about as a kid? Were you one of those kids who lay awake and thought about what other life could I be living?
Yeah, well, I think that's sort of the condition of being adopted in some ways, is that it asks you to think about some of the questions that other people don't necessarily have to think about, although I think it applies to everyone. I mean, I could have been adopted by any number of people. Would I have been a different person? Would I have had a different life arc than I do?
And we're raised by different parents at different stages of our lives.
Yeah.
You know, it's not as though our parents are the same people all the way through, are they?
Do you ever have that weird realization when you're hanging out with your kids and you think, oh, my mom was this age when she was hanging out with me, and this is what it felt like to be her? And suddenly you see them in a very different light. That's another kind of ghost, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
You get to see the ghost of your mom as she really was, or as she maybe was experiencing, instead of mom, which is a completely different relationship.
So far, we've been talking about the creepier side of ghosts, but you mentioned you also lost your wife. I know she died a few years ago from cancer. Did that bring you new sorts of thoughts about ghosts?
Well, I think that losing my wife has been sort of a defining thing for me in the last few years and has really altered the way that I exist in the world. I think the saddest aspect of it is that I didn't really get to see her ghost, or I haven't yet. You know, I expected that in some ways it would be the most natural thing that I would see her. And in some ways, the most unnatural thing is not seeing her. She's just not there.
She was a writer.
Yeah, she was a writer.
A writing teacher.
She was my writing teacher. We were actually together since I was 19. Basically, my entire adult life was spent with Sheila. And we shared a lot of things. We shared a sense of humor, a sense of the importance of writing. We were both teachers. We were one another's biggest fans.
But I was wondering what you do have is her books.
I do have
her
books.
She was a short story writer, and she published her first novel, sadly, posthumously, came out after she died. But you have all those stories, which you must read and reread, find new things in.
Yeah. I'm actually in the process of editing her last short story collection, which she was working on when she died. It actually took me longer than I feel was proper to get the guts to go back and start editing it. It was pretty hard. I mean, I think it's getting to a point where you can go back to those stories as if you're visiting the lost person. For a long time, it was too hard to visit because you knew that you couldn't stay.
Yeah.
Yeah. You mean they weren't really going to come back with you. I'm just thinking that sales of antidepressants are going to rise after this episode of To the Best of Our Knowledge has aired.
Well, but I think the point of your what we've been saying and of your fiction is that the state of being haunted is not necessarily such a bad thing.
No, I don't think it is. I think sometimes that is an American problem, thinking that it would be fantastic to be happy all the time. I don't think it would be fantastic to be happy all the time, because I think you need the other side of it to be really happy. And the part of going to this other place where you look at ghosts and you think about your own mortality and your own mistakes is one way to go back to your life right now and be happy and grateful for it.
Stay awake. Don't nod and dream.
Stay Awake is a collection of short stories by Dan Shaun. And now for something completely different. An interview with someone who probably takes Halloween way more seriously than you do, the Magistra Templi Rex of the Church of Satan.
Satan represents indulgence instead of abstinence. Satan represents kindness to those who deserve it instead of love wasted on ingrates. Satan represents vengeance instead of turning the other cheek.
That's coming up. I'm Ann Strangechamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX.
We're live, we're local, we are Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas. We're 91.5 Lawrence and 91.3 Olsburg, Junction City. You can find us online at kansaspublicradio.org. Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge on KPR comes from the Treatment and Recovery Center of Douglas County, offering 24/7 walk-in services for mental health or substance use crises. Located at 1000 West 2nd Street in Lawrence. More at trcdgks.org. The holiday season will be swinging with KPR's Big Band Christmas. Join us Saturday night, December 14th at Liberty Hall. We'll be there with the Kansas City Jazz Orchestra for some big band hits and Christmas favorites, too. Find out more at our website.
I'm haunted by the food I eat. How lame is that?
A ghost story from listener Jonathan Blythe.
I didn't understand my apartment was slowly accumulating spectral barnyard animals. Phantom pigs rooting in my living room. Ghostly chickens foraging in the carpet. Seriously, ghostly chickens. There's a flock of them roosting in the laundry room now. I can't describe the feeling of seeing these hundreds of animals milling around my place, knowing I've eaten every one of them. It's not that they're spooky exactly, just that there's so many of them. I was lucky to be standing by the sink when a spectral squid flailed its tentacles out of the 6-quart pot in which I was boiling rigatoni for dinner, with meatballs. The cow will probably turn up one of these days. Of course, the first time a bear lumbered through the kitchen, I just about wet myself. When did I ever eat a bear? Then I remembered that super yummy homemade pepper sausage my neighbor Randall makes from wild game he hunts. Who knows what all goes in there? Anyway, that's how it is now. They're just part of my life. Like memories, but more vivid. I could go on about the herds of cattle or the clams crusting the toilet bowl, but the real reason why I'm now strictly a vegetarian is this. 3 days ago, a girl showed up. 16, maybe. Pretty. With short brown pixie hair. The second I saw her, my mind reeled and I started to feel cold. My stomach began churning. She just looked at me, not angry, at least not at me, just serious, and said nothing. Neither do the tall black woman and boy of around 10 who arrived yesterday morning. I don't know where they came from, but I can guess. I just hope it wasn't the pepper sausage, because it was really good, know what I mean? I liked it.
Thanks to Wisconsin listener Jonathan Blythe for that story, read by Stephen Montagna. So what if the best way to confront your fear is to poke a stick at it, defeat it by making fun of it, belittling it, mocking it? Blanche Barton embraces this idea to the nth degree. She's the Magistra Templi Rex of the Church of Satan, and until recently, its High Priestess. Her book, The Church of Satan, is the go-to guide on the history of the religion. Steve Paulson started with this simple question. Does she really worship Satan?
The idea of worshiping Satan is ridiculous. We worship ourselves, first and foremost, and we use the satanic as a metaphor for calling forth the powers within ourselves that we find enriching or enlivening. Satan has always been a metaphor of defiance, fortitude against all odds, self-determination. In whatever guises he is represented. And there has always been a satanic figure in every culture from the very beginnings of man, and I imagine there always must be.
But you could call your church the Church of Rebellion or the Church of Defiance. Satan is a very loaded word and, frankly, a turnoff to a lot of people. Why choose that figure of Satan?
We do that, Steve, exactly because of what you just said. It is loaded. Words are very powerful. Words are magical incantations, whether you're talking about Democrats and Republicans or Osama bin Laden or Adidas. They're all loaded with something behind them, and Satan has a lot of baggage. And I think by calling what he started the Church of Satan, Anton LaVey was underlining the fact that we are manipulated by language and that we should use it to our advantage, not be intimidated by things that are sold to us as evil. We should be very careful about things that are sold as wicked.
Well, speaking of words, it's striking that you use the name Satan rather than the devil. And I think Satan is even more powerful. The word Satan is even more powerful than the devil.
Satan is the adversary, the other, the outsider, and it is potent. Satan, in all of his guises, Lucifer, Prometheus, the fallen one, isn't he the best representative for the human? We both share the fall from grace, and we use whatever methods we can find for ourselves to redeem ourselves, if redemption is what we want. We can't be redeemed by somebody saving us. We have to summon up the power within ourselves. No one's going to come along and save us.
What are the Church of Satan's core beliefs?
Well, we do have the 9 satanic statements. I don't know whether you want me to read them or not.
Sure.
Well, this was published originally in 1969, and it's the core beliefs that all Satanists who understand what Anton LaVey put forth live by. Satan represents indulgence instead of abstinence. Satan represents vital existence instead of spiritual pipe dreams in all of their guises. Satan represents undefiled wisdom instead of hypocritical self-deceit. Satan represents kindness to those who deserve it instead of love wasted on ingrates. Satan represents vengeance instead of turning the other cheek. Satan represents responsibility to the responsible instead of concern for psychic vampires. Satan represents man as just another animal, sometimes better, more often worse, than those that walk on all fours, who because of his divine, spiritual, and intellectual development has become the most vicious animal of all. Satan represents all of the so-called sins as they all lead to physical, mental, or emotional gratification. And most importantly, number 9, Satan has been the best friend the church has ever had, as he has kept it in business all these years.
Okay, well, let me follow up on number 9. You're saying that without the concept of Satan, the church, particularly the Christian church, would have a hard time justifying itself?
There always has to be that balance. Not necessarily good versus evil, but what God represents generally. We're talking metaphorically, of course. Whether you believe in an actual God or not, that's your business. But metaphorically, at least, he represents conventionality, predictability, the safety of being within the norms and staying within the bounds of propriety. But there always have to be those pioneers, the ones who color outside the lines, the blasphemers, the ones that are unpredictable and unconventional, the bohemians. And that is the constant interplay of humanity. That's how we move forward and then pull back. That's the swinging of the pendulum. And that satanic element will always be there.
Now, one thing that's striking about a lot of these satanic statements is they basically praise selfishness and hedonism. Is that a fair way to characterize what the Church of Satan believes in?
Well, selfishness is very practical, I think. We're all selfish, and for a very good reason. Of course, what gives me pleasure is often contributing to society. Those who mean the most to me, my parents, my children, my friends, and there is certainly room for love and even sacrifice for a Satanist. But unlike many other spiritual religions, we don't need a good guy badge. Anton LaVey used that as a phrase, meaning a big patch on your chest or on your sleeve that says, I'm a good guy, I'm doing good things, I'm a white witch, I'm okay. We understand that it's not necessary to do that. You don't have to broadcast it, but it's necessary and it feeds you. What is selfish for me, it gives me pleasure to see people I love happy.
When I listen to you, I mean, you seem very serious about all of this, and yet as you were reciting these 9 satanic statements, there's a certain element of a joke in all of this. Or having fun with the whole concept of the commandments. I mean, for instance, number 5, Satan represents vengeance instead of turning the other cheek. I get the sense that there's a little bit of a chuckle as that statement was devised. Am I right about that?
Well, there is definitely a chuckle and a wink. Anton LaVey came from a carny background. He was a man of music. He was a musician in his soul and by practice, but he also recognized the sense of humor. And a magician is not worth his salt if he doesn't have a sense of humor and a sense of perspective about himself. Pretentiousness is one of our sins. And every time, whenever Anton LaVey was interviewed or in his writings, you'll notice that if he starts slipping into pedantry, he tends to undercut it with a joke. He turns it around. I think it's always necessary. But if you interpret that as saying that he was just selling this to people, that would be wrong, because Satanists are very serious about this philosophy. But we also understand that humor is one of humanity's saving graces.
There's a popular image of what satanic worshipers do. There are animal sacrifices and altars of naked women, the black mass. Is any of this what you do?
Well, we definitely use the altars of naked women. We glorify the flesh, and so what's more fleshly and enticing and lovely than the naked female form? So in group rituals, sometimes we choose that. In solitary rituals, obviously, we don't. But there are no animal sacrifices, actually. If you read the Satanic Bible, it's very clear that we consider children and animals the most native magicians, because they're the most influenced by their purest instincts, and they don't have the layers and layers of social conditioning laid upon them.
Now, we've been having fun to some degree with this whole idea. I mean, you're poking fun at religious traditions, but there is a dark side to the whole tradition of satanic worship. I mean, some people have really run with this and done some horrible things. Charles Manson, who committed his atrocious murders invoking Satan, as I recall. And I guess the question is, does your church, the Church of Satan, have any responsibility for some of those people who go off the deep end?
There are always the darker myths. And Satanists, true Satanists, use them to combat your own fears and that which holds you back from your best accomplishments. There will always be those who use whatever they want to justify their violence or their counterproductive actions. And Satanists recognize them for what they are and believe that they should be punished accordingly.
Now, I'm willing to bet that a lot of people would see the very idea of Satan as a construction of Christianity, and the Church of Satan is sort of the flip side of that, the inversion of core Christian beliefs. And I guess it raises the question, does your church only work in a largely Christian culture?
No. As I was saying earlier, there's always the satanic, whether it's Sumeria or ancient Greece or some unimaginable culture in our far-flung future. There will always be the outsiders, the pioneers, the blasphemers, and they will always, by whatever name they are conjured, they will always be the ones exploring the murkier borderlands where discoveries are made.
Blanche Barton is Magistra Templi Rex of the Church of Satan, and until recently she was its High Priestess. She's the author of The Church of Satan, A History of the World's Most Notorious Religion. Steve Paulson talked with her.
Yes, you're going to hell.
To the best of our knowledge, comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. Charles Monroe Kane produced this hour, with help from Angela Bautista, Shannon Henry Kleiber, and Mark Rickers. Joe Hartke is our sound designer and technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. Happy Halloween.
Yes, you're going to hell.
Where did they find that song? From the University of Kansas, we are Kansas Public Radio, KANU and KANU HD1, Lawrence 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1, Emporia 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1, Olsburg Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute 90.3. Tell your smart speakers to play Kansas Public Radio. Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge on KPR comes from the Midwest Trust Center at Johnson County Community College, featuring the Opus 76 Quartet, Christmas with the Celts, and more this season. Single tickets available at jccc.edu/Midwest Trust Center. Coming up next here on Kansas Public Radio, it's NPR's News Quiz. Wait, wait, don't tell me. The time is 12 o'clock.
From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Bill Curtis.
And I'm Dulce Sloan, filling in for Peter Sagal. It's a weird Halloween week. Every time you say trick or treat, people think you're asking who they're voting for. And speaking of the election, we'll share the latest news in air travel for those who are planning on fleeing the country. Plus, sports icons Sue Bird and Megan Rapinoe go for the gold in our game, and Bill Curtis renegotiates his contract.
Would you like 3 more months at half price?
We'll ask who's really changing their terms on our quiz right after this hour's news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Just over a week before Election Day, Donald Trump is holding a rally in New York City, a deep blue city in a blue state, with a long list of special guests. NPR's Daniel Kurtzleben reports.
Trump supporters poured out of the New York subway Sunday morning, lining up hours ahead of Donald Trump's scheduled 5 p.m. speech at Madison Square Garden. The rally is a homecoming of sorts for Trump, who grew up in nearby Queens. Trump has done other New York rallies this year as well, including in the Bronx and on Long Island. A three-hour program of speakers is opening for Trump, with House Speaker Mike Johnson, former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani, and Tesla CEO Elon Musk all slated to take the stage. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News, New York.
Meanwhile, his Democratic opponent, Vice President Harris, is campaigning across the city of Philadelphia today. NPR's Asma Khalid reports.
Harris began her day with remarks at a black church in West Philly.
In this moment, we do face a real question. What kind of country do we want to live in? That's before us right now. What kind of country do we want for our children and our grandchildren? A country of chaos, fate, fear, and hate, or a country of freedom, justice, and compassion? And the great thing about living in a democracy is we, the people, have the choice to answer that question.
This is the central part of Harris's closing argument. She's trying to create a clear contrast with Trump, and she'll try to make that case today as she campaigns in black and Latino neighborhoods across Philly. Asma Khalid, NPR News, Philadelphia.
Japan held general elections today. The ruling party appears to have lost its majority in the parliament. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports.
Public broadcaster NHK's exit polls show the ruling Liberal Democratic Party, or LDP, winning a maximum of 219 seats, down from 247. That's below the 233 seats they need for a majority in the House of Representatives. The main opposition Constitutional Democratic Party is expected to gain seats, but it too will be short of a majority. The LDP has ruled Japan since 1955, with only two short exceptions. But voters are angry at the LDP over a slush fund scandal and the party's apparent lack of remorse for it. Their lack of a majority could force them to cobble together a new governing coalition, possibly with opposition parties. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Seoul.
Israel is holding memorial ceremonies today to honor those killed in the Hamas attack on Israel last October, as well as the civilians and soldiers killed in the war in Gaza since then. The violence continues. Health officials in Gaza say more than 30 people were killed in attacks in northern Gaza last night, and in central Israel, a truck rammed into a bus stop near Tel Aviv, wounding dozens of people before the driver was shot dead. This is NPR News in Washington. Almost 400 authors, some behind bestsellers, have signed an open letter calling for a boycott of Israeli cultural institutions amid the war in Gaza. Vicky Barker reports from London. The boycott has also raised concerns about a ban on Israeli forces.
Irish novelist Sally Rooney, Indian writer Arundhati Roy, and U.S. author Percival Everett are among the hundreds promising to boycott any Israeli publishers, book festivals, or literary agencies that have not spoken out against their country's role in the war in Gaza, accusing them of being, quote, complicit in genocide. The open letter, organized by the Palestine Festival of Literature, will be released on the social platform X on Monday. The Times of London reports Lee Child, author of the Jack Reacher novels, opposes the campaign, urging his fellow writers, quote, not to attack the very people whose hearts are still in the right place. For NPR News, I'm Vicky Barker in London.
In baseball's World Series, the Los Angeles Dodgers are ahead 2-0 after beating the New York Yankees in Los Angeles last night. The Dodgers hope their star outfielder will be okay to play in the next game. Shohei Ohtani partially dislocated his shoulder when he tried to steal second base in the seventh inning. Los Angeles manager Dave Roberts says more tests are needed.
I can't speculate because we don't get the scans yet. So once we get the scans, we'll know more. But again, with the strength and range of motion good, that's certainly a positive.
The World Series moves to New York. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing extraordinarily creative individuals with a track record of excellence. More information on this year's MacArthur Fellows is at macfound.org.
We're live, we're local, we are Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas. We're 91.5 Lawrence and 91.3 Olsburg Junction City, online at kansaspublicradio.org. Sunny and warm this afternoon with highs getting up to the mid-70s, even warmer for tomorrow with highs in the mid-80s. It's 64 in Lawrence, 66 in Manhattan, 64 in Topeka. This is KPR.
The following program was taped in front of an audience of real live people.
From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. Get out your diaper cream. I'm the voice as smooth as a baby's butt. I'm Bill Curtis, and here's your host at the Studebaker Theater at the Fine Arts Building in Chicago, Illinois, filling in for Peter Sagal, Dulce Sloan.
It's me! Hey! Thank you! Thank you, Bill, and thanks, everybody. We have a great show for you today. Now, I know some of y'all are wondering, how did she get this job filling in for Peter Sagal? I mean, well, who knew that a man who runs so much couldn't beat me in a leg wrestling match? Later on, we'll be talking to sports power couple Sue Bird and Megan Rapinoe about their new podcast, A Touch More. But first, it's your turn to touch us more. I'm single. By giving us a call, the number is 888-WAIT-WAIT. That's 888-924-8924. Now let's welcome our first listener contestant. Hi, you're on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Hi, my name is Katie Peel, and I'm calling from Denver, Colorado.
Now, what do you do in this here Denver, Colorado, up there in the mountains where you can't breathe?
Well, I am a recently resigned public school teacher, and I manage a small coffee shop and a farm-to-table restaurant.
Ooh, okay.
That's very Colorado.
Very NPR.
Well, Patty, hey, girl, hey! Let me introduce you to our panel. First is a comedian performing soon in Sunnyvale, California, and Erie, PA, and host of the trivia podcast, Go Fact Yourself, airing now on LAS Public Radio. It's Helen Hong!
Hello! Hi, Katie!
Next, the comedian will be part of Kyle Kinane's Kinane's Giving Show on November 27th at the Talia Hall in Chicago. It's Adam Burt.
Hello, Katie.
And the comedian will be at Helium Comedy Club in Philadelphia November 9th through the 11th. It's Alonzo Bode.
Hello, Katie.
Hey, girl. Welcome to the show, Katie. Now, you're going to play Who's Bill This Time? Bill Curtis is going to read you three quotes from this week's news. If you can correctly identify or explain two of them, you'll win our prize, any voice from our show you choose on your voicemail. You ready? Yep. Okay. Here's your first quote.
All the single ladies, all the single ladies, all the single ladies, all the single ladies.
That was somebody adding her name to the many celebrities endorsing Kamala Harris this week. Who was it?
Beyonce?
Beyonce! With less than 2 weeks till election day, the celebrity endorsements are rolling in. Harris has now wrapped up Beyonce, Eminem, Taylor Swift, and Bruce Springsteen, while Trump has earned the endorsements of Joe Exotic from Tiger King and a bunch of people on Jeffrey Epstein's flight dossier. And it's not officially an endorsement. You know, Beyonce just appeared at a Kamala Harris rally in Houston yesterday. You know, it was a move that you know, she said, I support Kamala, but not enough to fly to Pennsylvania. And that is my Beyonce impression.
I love that because they keep saying, oh, it's unofficial. It's unofficial. Like, really? Really, Beyonce is unofficially endorsing Kamala? Come on, I think we're a little bit past coy.
What if she was a big RFK person? What if Beyonce was like, I don't know, there's just something about him.
That's the question. Where's the surprise? Is anyone surprised that Beyonce is supporting Kamala Harris? Only people who surprise are the people who still claim to be undecided. Right, those geniuses who are like, oh, well, if Beyonce's involved, maybe I can make a decision. I mean, what other endorsement? Who else could there be?
Well, we did have a very, according to my notes, this week we also got the October surprise, the endorsement that could change the race. Now, Kamala Harris, this is true, got the endorsement of, wait for it, the Insane Clown Posse. Because, like, you know, things are getting crazy when Shaggy Too Dope is out here calling for a saner clown posse.
All right, Dulce, you backed me into a corner. I, Alonzo Bowden, now officially endorse Kamala Harris.
Thank you.
Oh. I'm in.
Alonzo.
I'm in.
I'm shocked.
I'm in.
I was at the edge of my seat the entire time.
Who knew? You can relax.
I didn't even know you were a juggalo, but. Didn't Trump got a huge endorsement this week? Trump was endorsed by E. coli.
Oh, yeah. He was pretending to work at that McDonald's.
Yeah, and 5 days after he worked at McDonald's, E. coli was like, well, if you let him in, you gotta let us in.
All right, Katie, here's our next quote.
Are you sure? Would you like 3 more months at half price?
Those are questions we may never see again, thanks to a new federal ruling making it easier to do what?
I'm not sure. Can I have a hint?
Okay, I can give you a hint. Like, say you want to stop the gym. Like, you know how Planet Fitness will con you into thinking you're going to come back? This new law will make it easier for you to not have to eat donuts in a gym.
Gym membership?
You know what, Katie? You were close enough. It's cancel subscription. Cancel subscription.
Oh.
The new law is called Click to Cancel. It requires that you be able to cancel a subscription the same way you signed up for it, right? Yeah. This is the kind of news that is going to have a million Americans going, wait, I subscribed to Peacock?
So this works. So this allows you to cancel the same way you signed up. So do I have to be drunk?
I think that's between you and your God. Because, like, under the rule, like, if you sign up with one click, you have to be able to cancel with one click. So, you know, you just look for, like, a little button on the screen that's like a little puppy that says, but if you cancel, I'll stop.
Now, do you have to subscribe to Click to Cancel in order to click to cancel? That's going to be the next thing. Are you subscribed to Click to Cancel? No, well, then you can't click to cancel.
I don't know if we've hit that rabbit hole yet.
Can they just have a button to tell Duolingo just to calm the hell down? Like, just like, I'll learn French on my own time. Just stop yelling at me.
All right, Katie, here's your last quote.
For fonder farewells, please use the parking lot.
That is a new sign at an airport in New Zealand, the first in the world to institute a rule limiting what to 3 minutes or less.
Like a goodbye hug?
Yes! Citing the delays caused by long goodbyes, an airport in New Zealand is now limiting hugs in the drop-off zone to 3 minutes or less. So get ready to look over from that long hug and see a TSA agent standing there with a stopwatch and a taser.
They're going to regret the specificity of that language, of that word hug, when people are like, well, technically we're having sex. I'm not... My arms aren't anywhere near her.
Which I mean, still you can get done in 3 minutes if you've got a flight. My thing is, and I don't know what airports, I guess it's different in New Zealand. Any airport I've been to, you can't have your car parked in front for 3 minutes.
Yeah. Right?
You stop and that cop's like, wait a minute, keep moving. So,
I mean, I would love to meet the bitter, lonely, can't get a ride to the airport ass person who came up with this
one. This is from an airport in New Zealand, which I feel like this is so off brand for New Zealand that I'm convinced this is one airport official in New Zealand who just has a really clingy mother. Who's just like, honey, and he's like, Mom, I know, but the rules, and also, can't feel my left shoulder anymore. I'm sorry, I have to go.
Well, it could be the fact that every flight from New Zealand is so long that you got to say goodbye like, you know, I may never see you again. You're about to board this 19-hour flight to civilization.
That is true.
Oh, like flying Spirit Airlines. It's like, this hug going to be long. Because I might not make it out of the bad neighborhood that is this plane.
A three-minute long hug is a really long hug.
No, it's not!
Yes, it is!
What is wrong with y'all? 3 minutes is not a long time!
Listen, you can microwave 2 frozen burritos in 3 minutes. Do you know how much you can get done in 3 minutes? That is an epic hug, 3 minutes.
All right. Bill, how did Katie do on our quiz?
She's a champion. She got them all right.
Yay!
Go, Katie.
Good going, Katie.
Don't worry, Katie. I'll do your voicemail, girl.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Right now, panel, time for you to answer some questions from this week's news. All right. Now, Alonzo, if you work in New York City, a new bill says that you can use a sick day not just when you're sick, but also when your what is sick?
Your dog, your pet.
Yes!
Yeah,
absolutely.
When your dog is sick. A New York City councilman is introducing a law that would require employers to let people use sick days if their dog is sick. Now, it makes sense because you don't want to be the guy in the office who gave everybody heartworms.
Well, this is an interesting law in New York because they're New Yorkers. If a New Yorker calls in sick and you say, what's wrong with you? You get none of your business. I'm sick.
Yeah.
And they go on about, you know, their day. Huh?
Do you have to prove, like, do you have to get on a Zoom call with your boss and hold up, you know, Buddy, and Buddy's just like...
And what if it's one of those breeds that always looks sick?
Yeah.
Oh,
like,
that's
a, like a Frenchie or yeah, something yeah. That's just like... And you're like, see? He can't even breathe. Come on.
Also,
I don't know about all these anti-dog people, but if my dog is sick, I ain't showing up.
Yeah, all right. We're clapping that because that's the most American nonsense I've ever heard. Like, sick days for dogs and Amazon employees don't get any? Like, if I was an Amazon employee, I would start dressing up like a shih tzu just so I could get a couple of days off.
Greetings in our Bluff the Listener game. Call 1-888-WAIT-WAIT to play. We'll be back in a minute with more of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Environmental scientists see a silver lining to the Colorado River drought. Native plants are taking root on land re-emerging from dried out reservoirs there.
It turns out nature is doing a pretty good job by itself of coming back and establishing thriving ecosystems.
That story on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered this afternoon from 4 to 5 o'clock on Kansas Public Radio. From the University of Kansas, we're 91.5 Lawrence and 89.7 Emporia. We're online at kansaspublicradio.org. Support for Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on KPR comes from Delta Dental of Kansas, reminding listeners that dental checkups can help identify health conditions like heart disease, diabetes, and more. Dentists can be found at deltadentalks.com/find. Just in time for Halloween, the Haunted States of America. Next time on KPR Presents, it's a cross-country trip of spooky stories. We'll visit with William Mockrey and Giselle Anatole about their contributions to this anthology for middle school readers. That's on KPR Presents, 6 o'clock this evening on Kansas Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Subaru. Subaru has donated more than $60 million to support the adoption, rescue, transport, and health of more than 504,000 animals. Learn more at Subaru.com/pets. Midi Health, committed to providing a supported path to symptom relief for women in perimenopause and menopause, offering personalized virtual care. Learn more at joinmidi.com. And Progressive, with small business insurance for protecting a variety of business types with multiple coverage options designed to fit business owners' needs. More about small business insurance is at progressivecommercial.com. From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Bill Curtis. We are playing this week with Adam Burke, Alonzo Bowden, and Helen Hong. And here again is your host at the Studebaker Theater in Chicago, Illinois, filling in for Peter Sagal, it's Dulce Sloan.
Thank you. Right now it's time for the Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me Bluff the Listener game. Call 1-888-WAIT-WAIT to play our game on air or check out the pinned post on our Instagram page at Wait, Wait, NPR. Hi, you're on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Hi, this is Kristen from Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh! I've been to Pittsburgh! What you do in Pittsburgh, girl?
I'm a high school teacher, and in my spare time, I volunteer at a cat rescue called Pittsburgh Cat.
Yeah!
Oh. All right.
Thank you for helping the kitty cats. It's so nice to have you, Kristen. Now, you're going to play our game in which you must try to tell truth from fiction. What's the topic, Bill?
Greeting cards in the news.
Ooh! Greeting cards, the perfect way to tell someone you do care about them, but not enough to send an actual gift. Our panelists are going to tell you about an incident involving a greeting card that made the news this week. Pick the one who's telling the truth, and you'll win our prize, the Wait Waiter of your choice, on your voicemail. Are you ready to play, Kristen?
I am ready.
Hey, first up, it's Helen Hong.
Getting laid off is never fun. But getting laid off and not even getting a goodbye card from your coworkers? Well, that's just criminal. That's what a woman claimed in court when she sued British Airlines for not giving her a farewell card when she left the company. The cardless woman, who happened to be named Karen, was so offended that she took legal action. Cardless Karen and the obviously not great lawyer who took on her case had a rude awakening in court when a former colleague testified that they did buy a card, but they didn't give it to her because only three people signed it. Awkward. Undaunted, Cardless Karen is now preparing lawsuits against a busload of strangers who didn't all say bless you after she sneezed.
A greeting card lawsuit from Helen Hong. Your next noteworthy note card comes from Adam Burke.
Nothing says you care for someone like a homemade greeting card, and nothing says you really care for them like getting a professional to make it for you. But not everyone can afford their own writers and artists, which is where bespoke greeting card startup Heart Murmurs comes in. The Iowa-based company seeks to automate the process by using AI to write and design cards tailored to your loved ones. Explains founder Hans Bowman, For our initial testing, we wanted to see what we'd get with zero human intervention. It was here the limitations started to show, with participant Lisa Crowther having to apologize to her 72-year-old mother after the latter received a gaudily decorated card that read, "Roses are red, and neither are you. F. Patrick Mahomes, you're 72. As Bowman explains, the AI scrubs your social media to sound more like you, so if you say a lot of profane things about the Chiefs, that might come up. Even more bizarre were some of the attempts at festive missives, with one Ellis Hoskins getting a card reading, "Happy holidays, Ellis. Santa is coming for you. There is no escape. Ho, ho, ho." Clearly we've got some work to do, says Bowman.
All right. AI going a little too far from Adam Burke. And your last story of some paper in the paper comes from Alonzo Bowden.
When Motor Week magazine writer Peter Seat finally met with the famous Airbags Car Club in Detroit, it wasn't just their collection of old cars that stood out. It was their collection of greeting cards. What's with all the cards? Well, founding Airbags member Gonzo Raymond isn't just the owner of a 1963 Impala convertible. He's also the owner of some very passionate opinions about e-cards. Turns out he hates them. So everyone started sending him cards, not just birthday and Christmas, cards for everything. Did you know April 14th is National Ex-Spouse Day? January 21st is Squirrel Appreciation Day? National Left-Handers Day is August 13th. They even got him a card for nothing on January 16th, because that's National Nothing Day.
Okay, Kristen. You've got Helen's story about a woman suing for not getting a farewell card, only to realize she had one. It was just too pathetic to give to her. Adam's story about an AI company writing cards that are a little too personal. And from Alonzo Bowden, e-cars turn an old car collector into a greeting card collector. Which story is the real story?
Okay, this is pretty tough. But I think I'm going to go with Adam's story because as a teacher, I encounter a lot of bad AI sometimes from students who are rushed to get an assignment in.
Oh, okay. Well, to find out the correct answer, we spoke to someone covering the real story.
They discovered that the company had a card for Karen, but only two or three people were actually willing to sign it.
That was Allison Levins from the Hammer and Nigel show talking about the real story of the card no one wanted to sign. I'm sorry, Kristen, but Helen had the real answer.
That's so great.
I'm sorry you didn't win, but you did earn a point for Adam. Thanks for playing with us. Goodbye. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
I went and stayed too long. I'm wondering if your love's still strong. Ooh, baby, here I am, still delivered. I'm yours.
And now it's time for a game we call Not My Job. Basketball and soccer legends Sue Bird and Megan Rapinoe are a true sports power couple with 7 Olympic medals, countless championships, and a Presidential Medal of Freedom between them. Oh, where y'all keep all these medals at? They're also the hosts of A Touch More, a show about women's sports that's, given their track record, will probably be the first podcast to win a Nobel Prize. Sue Bird and Megan Rapinoe, welcome to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me! Okay, so since y'all got all these accolades, do you prefer legends or ghosts? Like, how do you like to be referred to?
Legend.
Legend.
Okay. That's classy. So, I do have a question about y'all's podcast. It's called A Touch More, correct? Now, I want to know, how did you shift the podcast from, like, a tipsy Instagram live to, like, a full podcast?
Well, we took out the tipsy part. That helps. Got a couple of Google Docs going, and that's basically it.
That's basically it.
We're pretty much doing the same thing.
We have no idea what we're doing.
Sam's
is really what it is.
I know. We're like, who gave us these jobs? We did.
So, Miss Sue, whose a dream guest for the podcast?
Ooh, a dream guest. I mean, we wouldn't mind having Kamala Harris on, so that would be nice. This is Have Megan, you, praying for President Harris.
Yeah.
Have you called Beyonce? Because she knows her.
She's got an in.
Yeah.
I'll text her when we're done.
Be like, hey, Beyonce, we need Ms. Harris's number.
Thank you. Okay, now, I do have some questions. Y'all are like just like this, you know, super sports power couple, just the strongest calves of any relationship. I do have a question. Since y'all are just these iconic, like, legends of sports, do you remember watching each other play, like, before y'all met each other? Did y'all, like, were y'all fans of each other before y'all met? Megan
says yes. Megan watched me in college. How do we feel about this?
Yeah, I do wonder, like, are y'all very competitive because you are sports? So it makes sense, you know, medals and stuff. A family game night. Is it better if y'all are on the same team or opposing teams?
Megan won't play games, y'all. Like, Megan won't play games. It's so frustrating.
Really?
She won't play cards. She won't play anything.
I'll play some cards, but I don't like to be competitive in life. Even on the field, I was like...
Girl, what? You have medals. They gave you a big ass shoe.
I always figured the person who won 4 World Cups wasn't that competitive.
I mean, we were gonna win, you know.
I like that. So there's 7 Olympic medals, there's championships, there's a giant shoe, a medal of freedom. Where do y'all put all these awards? Does your living room just look like a high school lobby? Like, is that, where do y'all?
We actually have none of it in the house.
None of it.
What?
It's all like in storage or in a safe or something.
We basically, so one year we decided, let's be smart about this and buy a safe. So we bought like one of those, you know, small ones, whatever you put in like a closet, and then we put it in there, but we never got to the part where you have to, like, drill it into the wall. So somebody could just really come and take the safe is really what I'm saying.
This sounds like the most insane episode of Storage Wars in about 10 years.
I'm just thinking of all the people you two have beaten for championships and medals and honors, and they're like, they don't even care. I trained my whole life. They don't even care. The medal's locked away somewhere.
I cried when I lost.
And there's an unsecured safe just floating around somewhere.
I could have just waited and got a jackhammer.
Basically.
Yeah.
Might as well be in a shoebox. Jeez.
It was at one point. It was. Yeah, this is the upgrade.
Wow! Are you against just being ostentatious? Do you feel like it's too flashy? It's too gaudy? Like, why don't you have these?
A little bit, yeah.
Really?
You
and
are?
And, like, you're not going to wear them. They're heavy.
If I won a giant shoe, I would be wearing that thing around my neck every single day.
I would like your podcast to start with the sound of you just taking all your medals off. Clunk, 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 clunk.
The first 20 minutes of everybody. Actually, her.
Well, all right, Sue and Megan, we've asked you here today to play a game we're calling
Partners in Literal Crime.
So you two are a famous power couple. So we decided to ask you about an infamous power couple, Bonnie and Clyde, who also have 7 Olympic medals for bankrupt.
I want to know where they keep theirs.
In their coffins. Because they dead. Now, answer 2 of 3 questions right, and you'll win a prize for one of our listeners, the voice of anyone from our show on their voicemail. Bill, who are Sue Bird and Megan Rapinoe playing for?
Ren Hauptman of Seattle, Washington.
Hey! Friends, here's your first question. Bonnie and Clyde committed crimes across the U.S. in a stolen car before being gunned down by Texas Rangers. A surprising thing happened after their death. What? A, the local baseball team decided to change their name from the Texas Bank Robbers to the Texas Rangers. B, their life insurance policy was fully paid out because insurance companies did not yet have an exception for dying while committing a crime spree. Or C, the next year, the site of the shootout became the top location for weddings in all of Texas.
Yeah, I enjoy the whispering.
Why are
okay, what's the call it? Megan thinks it's C.
Okay.
Oh, my.
Wow. And Miss Suba,
do you agree
with your
yeah,
partner?
Yeah, final answer.
Do you agree?
We're going to go B.
B
joint together.
The answer is B. Their life insurance policy was fully paid.
You did it, Joe.
Here's your next question. Bonnie and Clyde are two of the most famous criminals of all time. But Frank Kamer, the Texas Ranger who finally caught them, has his own claim to fame. What? He's A, one of the earliest people on record to use the phrase bust a cap. B, he's the Frank that Frankfurters are named after. Or C, he hit number one on the charts with a song called I Shot Bonnie and Clyde. He's
okay,
one of
A. It's B.
You know what? Actually, yeah, it's A. Yes. After the shootout, Hamer said, quote, I hate to bust a cap on a woman. However, if it wouldn't have been her, it would have been us. And gangster rap was changed forever. What a thing to learn. All right.
Yeah.
Here is your last question. Bonnie and Clyde have a preferred getaway vehicle, the Ford V8 Model B. Apparently, Clyde loved the car so much that he once did what? A, got a tattoo of one on his arm next to the word Zoom. B, called the editor of the Dallas Morning News, insisting the paper referred to them as Bonnie and Clyde and their Ford V8 Model B. Or C, wrote Henry Ford a letter praising the car, quote, sustained speed and freedom from trouble.
Sue thinks today.
I can read the answer.
I think it's C.
The answer's C. But sadly for Ford, everyone knows that today the best getaway car is the Nissan Altima. Bill, how did Sue and Megan do on our quiz?
Proving they are always winners.
Hey, yeah. They got the pose. Come on, medals.
We would send you a trophy, but what would be the point?
Going to a storage unit in Silver Lake anyway. Sue Bird and Megan Rapinoe are legends in their respective sports. New episodes of their podcast, A Touch More, drop every Wednesday wherever you get your podcasts. So Sue Bird and Megan Rapinoe! Thank you so much for joining us on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Look for me, young B, cruising down the west side highway, doing what we like to do.
In just a minute, we reveal the underground wedding scene in our listener limerick challenge. Call 1-888-WAIT-WAIT to join us on the air. We'll be back in a minute with more of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
A therapy technique that involves looking at the self as multiple parts helped one man deal with his panic attacks.
The anxiety I've been feeling was one aspect of me, but not all of me. And in that moment, I felt this calm come over me.
We'll hear about a strategy to stress less. Monday on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Join us for Morning Edition tomorrow morning from 5 to 9 o'clock. Your hosts tomorrow, A. Martinez, Layla Fottle, and Jay Schaefer. From the University of Kansas, we're 91.5 Lawrence and 99.5 Manhattan. Tell your smart speaker to play Kansas Public Radio. Support for Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on KPR comes from Kansas City PBS, turning viewer support into education, arts, and news programming with the Kansas City PBS membership program. More at kansascitypbs.org. As a KPR listener, you can leave an inspired and lasting gift to our community by making a gift through your will. For more information, talk with your legal or financial advisor or email us at legacy@kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Indeed. Designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one platform. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. JTV Jewelry Television, offering a variety of gemstone jewelry with more than 70 different gemstones available. JTV can be found on TV or at jtv.com. And Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Bill Curtis. We are playing this week with Helen Hong, Adam Burke, and Alonzo Bowden. And here again is your host at the Studebaker Theater in Chicago, Illinois, filling in for Peter Sagal. It's Dulce Sloan.
Hey! Thank you! In just a minute, Bill has dinner with Busta Rhymes and our listener Limerick Challenge. If you'd like to play, call us at 1-888-WAIT-WAIT. That's 1-888-924-8924. But right now, panel, some more questions from the week's news. Adam?
Yep.
Now, you're familiar with TechNet, right?
Nope.
Okay. You're not up on the latest terms. So TechNet, the Quasimodo look you get after staring at your phone all the time,
okay,
right? Well, this week we read about a new way to get rid of it. What is it?
Throw your phone into the river.
Okay. What about a way to cover it up?
Oh, cover up tech. Is it like wear one of those travel pillows all the time?
You might say not all heroes.
Oh, is it? Oh, they're special like tech neck capes?
Yes, they are telling people
what?
To wear a cape to cover up your tech neck. If you weren't getting beat up enough. We're all, you know, crumbled over our phones 100 hours a day, giving our neck that fresh off of a, you know, roller coaster accident look. And it's called tech neck, or as your mother used to call it, stand up straight!
But now you can look like Supergirl doing it.
Or like, the crappiest superhero. It's Instagram Stalker Man.
I don't understand. Understand how the cape covers up the hunchback. Doesn't it make you just look like you have a hunchback with a cape on it?
No, that's what the pleats are for, Helen. The pleats.
Yeah.
Well, we also have the increasing intensity of these storms. Now, God forbid you're wearing your cape. When a Category 4 blows in, you are gone. What happened to him? Oh, that cape was tied a little too tight. Last seen floating over Indiana. I don't know.
So, when your cape gets caught in a revolving door and you get strangled to death, they'd be like, well, at least he doesn't have tech neck.
He has no neck. But he's fine now. Helen.
Yes?
Companies are trying a new way to capture buyers' attention in the store. It's packaging their products. How?
Packaging their products. I think I need a hint.
You thought you were getting out of M&M's. But surprise, it's paperclip.
Packaging their products in just the completely wrong packaging?
That is right.
What?
In a trend called chaos packaging. Companies are putting perfume and cleaner spray bottles, gin in motor oil containers. And for when you accidentally drink motor oil thinking it's gin, just look for your first aid kit in a nearby soup can.
What?
Like, companies are doing this for the same consumers that are eating Tide Pods in the correct packaging.
Isn't this called fraud?
I would think so, but also, and this is true, there's an ice cream tub of tampons!
Oh, man.
It's either brilliant marketing or Ben and Jerry's worst flavor
ever. This is definitely somebody at the factory quiet quitting. Like, quiet quitting really hard, and then just being like, you know, just put motor oil on.
No.
I don't know.
Does this work both ways? Can I take a can of peas to Nordstrom and say, I'm returning these designer shoes. I'd like my money back.
Ooh, that's good. Or I can take my ex and return him to his mom and be like, hey, you lied to me. On the outside, he was a good man, but on the inside, he's trash. I brought a receipt. Here, ma'am, take him back. Coming up, it's Lightning Fill in the Blank. But first, it's the game where you have to listen for the rhyme. If you'd like to play on air, call or leave a message at 1-888-WAIT-WAIT. That's 1-888-924-8924. You can catch us most weeks, including next week for a fun Halloween show, right here at the beautiful Studebaker Theater in Chicago! We'll be back at the Fox Theater in Detroit on the 14th of November. You can also join us in New York City. For tickets and info, go to nprpresents.org. Also, check out this week's How to Do Everything. Ian and Mike help you optimize your Halloween candy and talk to the Fonz himself about how to be a cool. Hi, you're on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
How is everybody? My name is John Blankenship.
And where are you from?
My family and I live in Franklin, Tennessee, just a few minutes south of Nashville.
I have been through Franklin, Tennessee. It is very nice. And what do you do for a living?
I work at a small digital marketing agency that one of my best friends started a couple of years ago.
I don't know what that job does. Welcome to the show, John.
I don't know what the job does half the time either. It's okay.
We're in the same boat. All right. Bill Curtis is going to read you three news-related limericks with the last word or phrase missing from each. If you can fill in that last word or phrase correctly on two limericks, you're a winner, baby! Now, here is your first limerick.
On a rail car, don't dress like a schlub, hey. And don't stand in the cheap catered grub's way. Champagne corks will pop as they're calling out stops, because our wedding is held on the...
Subway?
Yes.
That's right.
Good one.
In nasty news, there's a growing trend where people are holding weddings and receptions on the subway. It's perfect if your only guests are breakdancers, a mariachi band, and a tall person coughing directly onto a short person's head.
Is this in New York City?
Yes! And according to New York Times, the N-Train is the most sought-after wedding venue this year, and the wedding DJ is some guy watching YouTube without headphones.
I wouldn't mind going on a morning commute and suddenly being like, yeah, I'll have some cake, sure, yeah. Have some champagne.
When the train stops, just randoms jump on the train and like, hey, look, we're at a wedding.
Yeah, you can't hold up the... It's Babylon every time you get on a train car anyway. All right, here is your next limerick.
My love for green foods began rockily, but I know that they're good for me, luckily. And that sulfurous smell helps my body feel well. Now I'll really start eating more...
Broccoli.
Hey! Broccoli! Jonathan! The New York Times clearly had some extra time this week. Because after a thorough investigation, they're reporting that broccoli is healthy!
What?
I mean, of course it is. Look at it. It's a tiny tree.
So did they have like a guest editor this week that was just every mother from the 1970s?
Or some type of farm-to-table con job where somebody's like, I got this broccoli, you got to push. Call my brother at the New York Times.
Yeah, what? Big cauliflower couldn't afford it.
Because it was too busy being pizza. All right, Jonathan. Jonathan, here's your last limerick.
This resort meal is scenic and cool, but I got my eggs wet like a fool. There's chlorine in my drink. Drop my fork, now it sinks. Still, I love breakfast served in the
pool.
Hey! The fun new way for rich people to be ridiculous is to eat breakfast in the pool. The Washington Post reports that this is popular with influencers and other people trying to convince you to eat wet toast.
Also, with the Washington Post and the New York Times having a competition for the dumbest article.
Definitely a slow week on the news desk.
Bill, how did John do?
John is a perfect player.
Hey!
Hey!
Thank you, John, for listening.
Thank you so much. It was great to be on with you all. Thank you.
Thanks, John.
Thank you, man.
Have a good one, John.
Take care.
Thank you.
Grits and gravy. Grits and gravy. Cheese, eggs, and jam. Can't nobody cook it like you, girl. No, ma'am. This here early morning. Need something else on my plate. I think I want another.
Now on to our final game. Lightning fill in the blank. Each of our players will have 60 seconds in which to answer as many fill-in-the-blank questions as they can. Each correct answer is worth 2 points. Bill, can you give us the scores?
Adam and Helen each have 3. Alonzo has 2.
All right, Alonzo, you're in third place, yes. So you're up first. Fill-in-the-blank. During her CNN town hall on Wednesday, Kamala Harris said she believes that Donald Trump is a what?
Wow. We're just going to leave that open like that. I think it was fascist.
Yes. This week, states reported that over 28 million people had blanked early.
Voted.
Yes. This week, the U.S. announced that ceasefire talks with blank would resume.
Israel.
Yes. On Tuesday, the International Monetary Fund said that global blank rates have continued to fall.
Interest.
Inflation rates.
Oops.
Is that the same thing? Last week, the BBC apologized after their weather app forecasted blank in London.
Pennies from heaven?
13,000 mile per hour wind.
That was my next guess.
Absolutely. On Thursday, the New York Liberty was honored with a ticker tape parade after winning the blank championship.
WNBA.
Hey! This week, it was revealed that the big secret behind a German restaurant's best-selling pizza was that it came with the side of...
pizza from Italy?
I know this one. Do you know this one?
I know this
one.
Yeah.
Cocaine! So police said that anyone who ordered the number 30, you know, they thought it was weird. It would come with, like, breadsticks to drink and, like, a bag of cocaine. And weirdly enough, the same thing happened at that Chuck E. Cheese where the animatronic band was really into EDM. Bill, how did Alonzo do?
4 right, 8 more points, total of 10 puts him in the lead.
Okay, Adam, you're up next. Fill in the blank. After an E. coli outbreak linked to the restaurant, blank said its food is safe to eat.
McDonald's.
Right. On Thursday, the DA in Los Angeles announced plans to resentence the blank brothers.
The Menendez.
Right. This week, the White House confirmed that North Korea was sending soldiers to aid blank's war against Ukraine.
Russia.
Right. On Tuesday, it was ruled that Rudy Giuliani must turn over his Manhattan apartment to the blank workers he defamed.
Election workers?
Right. Weeks after it was discovered that many zoo pandas were just dogs in disguise, a shark at an aquarium in China was found to be a blank.
A panda in disguise.
A robot. On Tuesday, LeBron James made history by playing in an NBA game with his blank.
Son.
Right. On Wednesday, a Polish radio station announced it had replaced all its journalists with blank.
AI?
Right. This week, it was revealed that a team of hackers successfully overrode robot vacuums around the country and forced them to blank.
Rise up against their human oppressors.
And forced them to chase their human oppressors' pets around the house. The company that makes the vacuum said not only were the hackers able to remotely control the vacuums to chase pets around, but they were also able to talk through the built-in speakers, which raises the question, why does a vacuum need speakers? If no one's ever been like, man, I love my vacuum. I just wish it was louder.
If my Roomba's chasing my cat, can I call in sick in New York?
Yes. Okay, good. Bill, how did Adam do?
He got 6 rights, 12 more points, and the total is 15 in the lead.
Okay. So, Bill, how many does Helen need to win?
6 to tie, 7 to win.
Helen, you ready for the game?
I'm ready.
Okay, sis. On Wednesday, striking airplane mechanics again rejected a contract offer from blank.
Boeing.
Ha! Right. On Monday, aid workers warned of dire conditions for refugees trapped in blank.
Gaza.
Right. On Friday, President Biden formally apologized for the government's role in boarding schools that stripped blank of their culture and language.
Native Americans.
Right. For the first time, Vice President Kamala Harris said she supported raising the blank to $15 an hour.
Federal minimum wage.
Right. This week, footage revealed a sheriff in Georgia had called in 3 deputies for backup when he blanked.
Clogged a toilet.
When he got the wrong order at Burger King. This week, investigators confirmed that a newly opened fire station in Germany burned down because the fire department forgot blank.
Pay the water bill.
They forgot fire alarms.
Because they were eating pizza with cocaine on it.
Now, the firefighters could have saved it. The problem is they're taught to go down the pole. No one's ever taught them how to go back up. Bill, did Helen do well enough to win?
4 right, 8 more points, total of 11, means Adam Burke is the winner this week.
Congratulations, Adam. You are this week's champion. Now, coming up, our panelists predict, after the 3-minute-long hug, what will be the next surprising rule at the airport? But first, let me tell you that support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Angie, dedicated to helping homeowners find skilled pros to get their home projects done well. From everyday repairs to major remodels. Reviews, pricing, and booking are at Angie.com or on the Angie app. Midi Health, committed to providing a supported path to symptom relief for women in perimenopause and menopause, offering personalized virtual care. Learn more at joinmidi.com. And Progressive Insurance, with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is a production of NPR and WBEZ Chicago in association with Urgent Hair Care Productions, Doug Berman, and Benevolent Overlord. Philip Godica writes our limericks. Our public address announcer is Paul Friedman. Our tour manager is Shayna Donald, thanks to the staff and crew at the Studebaker Theater. BJ Lederman composed our theme. Our program is produced by Jennifer Mills, Miles Dornbos, and Lillian King. Special thanks to Blythe Robertson and Biniam Bazuna and Monica Hickey. This week, Peter Gwynn goes by Dulce Gwynn. Emma Choi is our vibe curator. Technical direction is by Lorna White. Our CFO is Colin Miller. Our production manager is Robert Newhouse. Our senior producer is Ian Chillog. And the executive producer of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is Mike Danforth. Now, panel, what will be the next rule at the airport? Alonzo Bowden.
The don't you know who I am people are not allowed to board the airplane because they don't know who they are.
Helen Hong.
If you get randomly selected for a pat-down inspection, the TSA officer first has to have a staring contest with you for 3 minutes.
And Adam Burke.
If your plane is a Boeing, your boarding pass will have a handy last will and testament printed on the back.
Well, if any of that happens, we're going to ask you about it on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Thank you, Bill Curtis! Thanks also to Adam Burke, Helen Hong, and Alonzo Bowden. And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Dulce Sloan, and we'll see you next week. This is NPR.
From the University of Kansas, we are Kansas Public Radio, KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute 90.3, K210CR in Atchison 89.9, and K258BT in Manhattan at 99.5. Online at kansaspublicradio.org. Support for Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on KPR comes from Blue Collar Press. Located in Lawrence, Kansas, Blue Collar Press helps businesses and creatives build their brands through merchandising, from design to production to fulfillment. More information at bluecollarpress.com. Just in time for Halloween, the Haunted States of America. Next time on KPR Presents, it's a cross-country trip of spooky stories.
I was six when I saw Samuel Dinsmore. Mom lifted me up in her arms as the tour guide shone a flashlight on his glass-topped casket. Every hair of his long bristly beard was perfectly preserved, but his sunken face was rotting away, shriveled, covered in white, crackling mold.
We'll visit with William Mockrey and Giselle Anatole about their contributions to this anthology for middle school readers. Also on this week's KPR Presents, what role will split-ticket voters play in the upcoming election? It's part two of Beyond the Ballot from the Dole Institute of Politics. That's on KPR Presents, 6 o'clock this evening on Kansas Public Radio. Coming up next here on KPR, it's the latest news from NPR, followed by Trail Mix with Bob McWilliams. I'm Kay McIntyre. Have a great afternoon.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. In the final 9 days of the campaign, Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump are making their closing arguments. NPR's Mara Liasson reports they're honing their messages aimed at a small yet critical group of voters.
Polls show many people simply don't believe Trump when he says he wants to terminate the Constitution or use the military against his opponents. So Harris has been calling more attention to Trump's words. She plays clips of his speeches at her rallies and warns about the danger she says the country faces if he is back in power. Meanwhile, Trump is also relying on a negative closing message. He says Harris is stupid and lazy and will allow the country to be invaded by hordes of criminal illegal aliens. Polls show the race is still a dead heat, and the candidates are competing for a tiny slice of undecided voters in just 7 states. Mara Liasson, NPR News.
Native American voters in 2020 were key in helping Democrats win Arizona for the first time in 2 decades. Now the Harris-Walz campaign appears to be making the same play. Adrian Scaboland of member station KNAU reports.
Minnesota Governor Tim Walz spoke below the sandstone cliffs of Window Rock, capital of the Navajo Nation, to a crowd of several hundred tribal members Saturday, arguing a President Kamala Harris will be good for Indian country.
The highest law is to honor tribal sovereignty, promote tribal consultation, and ensure tribal self-determination across this country.
Navajo officials say it's the first time a member of the presidential ticket has campaigned on the nation. In 1992, Hillary Clinton campaigned in the Navajo capital on behalf of her husband, and First Lady Jill Biden has made numerous visits. With Native Americans making up 6% of the state's population, it could be the difference Democrats need to win the state. For NPR News, I'm Adrian Scabland in Window Rock.
Iran's supreme leader has responded to Israel's weekend attack on key military targets. NPR's Arzu Rezvani reports.
While meeting with the families of 4 Iranian soldiers killed in Israel's attack, Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei said Israel exaggerated its destruction of Iran's defense system infrastructure. He refrained from calling for retaliatory strikes. Instead, he said the attack should be neither downplayed nor magnified. It was a tempered response from the Supreme Leader, who now faces a choice, to hit back and risk escalation or to stand down and risk looking weak. In a letter to the United Nations Secretary General, Iran's Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said Iran reserves the right to respond to Israel's, quote, criminal aggression. But it is Iran's Supreme Leader who has the ultimate authority to order strikes. Arzu Rezvani, NPR News, Beirut.
The UN Security Council may meet tomorrow to discuss the attacks at Iran's request. Iran claims they were a violation of international law. This is NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Midi Health, committed to providing a supported path to symptom relief for women in perimenopause and menopause, offering personalized virtual care. Learn more at joinmidi.com. Here are the Vote Sisters to open today's Trail Mix on Kansas Public Radio.
West Virginia, Blue Ridge Mountains, Shenandoah River. Life is old there, older than the trees, younger than the mountains, blowing like a breeze. Country roads take me home to the place I belong. West Virginia, mountain mama, take me home, country roads. All my memories gather round her, miner's lady, stranger to blue water. Dark and dusty, painted on the sky, misty taste of moonshine, teardrops in my eye. Country road.